Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to be talking about a little bit about immigration, a little bit about austerity, and a little bit about voting as well. But the immigration debate starting off all day today, the debate raged on. And for me, it comes down to some very simple things. One, I want to know who's coming and going. Two, I want to know how's it going to affect our workforce? What's it going to mean for low-waged workers? Because, look, while they're throwing this out, oh, we're going to get the best and the brightest from around the world, the reality is you're going to get an influx of less skilled, lower-skilled workers that are going to push down the bottom of the employment pool, which is what employers want. They want that guest worker program. They want that cheap labor that they can bring in and out. What's that going to mean for the bottom of the economic scale? For me, and I've said this from the beginning, this is where we need to have a strong labor law. We need to make sure that whatever the job is, it pays a living wage here. I get the idea that businesses want the cheap labor. I get that. But we need to have laws that, and this comes in a number of forms, higher minimum wage laws, stronger labor unions to make sure that the people taking those jobs and getting those jobs are paid accordingly, not allowing the exploitation and the cheating that's been going on, and that continues to rage on. Enough of this use of independent contractors. Hey, you're on your own, buddy. We've seen what this world looks like. Just go back to the 1880s, 1890s. This is where they want to return us to. And for me, this whole discussion, this whole debate, there's a lot of unanswered questions. The one thing I think that all the politicos have decided on is, well, we need more HB1 visas. We need to bring more people in, more labor in. Sorry, not all that interested in that. And you know, you look at the Bill Gates of the world, you look at the computer people saying, well, we need all of these smart people. Well, you know what? There's smart people here too. And you look at the education system, you look at what we've done to getting those jobs, some serious things to consider. So as this rages on, I'm hoping some questions are answered. You know, the other thing that gets me is this whole message around austerity. This whole we're broke thing. And on the way into work today, you know, I had one of those moments where, you know, I was talking to somebody about the big sinkhole in Chicago and, you know, how here in Harrisburg there have been 41 of these sinkholes, and all across the country they happen every day. And for me, it's the fact that we haven't invested in upkeep. We haven't invested in our nation. And he just looked at me flatly and said, well, you know what? We're broke. We don't have any money. And we can't do these things until we get our fiscal house in order. And gave me the whole right wing argument that he had heard. And I asked him, "Where'd you get this stuff?" Well, I hear it on the radio all the time. And it just sent me into a tizzy because, look, we're not broke. The lights are not going out. We're not shutting things down by choice. What's going on is you've got a party in this country, and some Democrats, the Republicans, and a lot of Democrats too, who have bought this idea that, well, we need austerity, we need to pull back. There's no money. Here's reality. And I've heard this, and look, you know, we've had people we've talked to who said, well, you know, the dollar's in trouble, and we've got all this debt, and we're saddled. On Monday, the Treasury Department released its report on foreign holdings. And if we're in such trouble, if we're so broke and our dollar is in such decline and all of that, why are foreign governments increasing their holdings of U.S. dollars? Now, I understand some of it, a good portion of it, is our trade deficit. But they're still holding large amounts of our dollars. You haven't seen that flood off yet. In fact, you know, we hear people say, well, you know, we're $16 trillion in debt. Well, foreign governments hold about $5.6 trillion of that. You know who holds the rest? Well, we do. The very wealthy in this country do. Our are pension funds. That's who holds it. And you look at China, who holds a little over $1.2 trillion of our money. You go, you know what, how we could save that? Same rational trade policy. Some manufacturing at home. There's a thought. Also, Japan, number two still, with almost $1.1 trillion in holdings. And you go, well, how are they number one and number two? How is that possible? And for me, a lot of it is currency manipulation, that we've allowed them to manipulate their currency so that their manufacturing base is stronger. And look, from a purely policy standpoint, I understand why they're doing it. To benefit their people, to give jobs to their people. That seems, you know, I get it. We're the suckers in this. We're the ones who are the ones giving our manufacturing base away. So when I hear people say, well, we're broken, we can't get money, we can't invest, we don't, you know, here again, this doesn't look like there's any trouble in borrowing money from the international community to invest. And at almost free rates is what's interesting to me. As close to zero interest as you're ever going to get. Now, that could all come tumbling down this summer, because as you know, as part of the debt, the fiscal cliff, or the fiscal mirage, they pushed raising the debt ceiling off until May 19th. That whole deal was, you can go above the debt ceiling and we'll authorize that till May 19th. Which, you know, the summer should be interesting, another manufactured crisis. Now, all of that could change. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out. And again, the Republicans have signaled that they're going to use this as another hostage situation, because they're still pushing this theory of austerity. They're still pushing this as God's honest word. And the reality is it's a theory that's been disproven time and time again, and it's basically bogus. And if you look at this, the latest information that's come out about this paper that basically the entire right and the austerity movement of the globe has bought into, this paper, Growth in a Time of Debt, by Carmen Reinhart and Kenneth Rogoff, that's been taken really, you know, as God's honest truth. And it basically said, look, if you have a debt to GDP ratio that's 90%, if you have a debt that's 90% of your GDP, that's when things start going straight downhill. So if you make 10 bucks and they say you've got 90 cents in debt, then everything else is going straight to pot. Anything over that, it's over. And you've got the right, who's going, well, see, we're much more than that. And we're almost getting there. I think it's 72% right now. We're at, they're saying, well, we're almost there. So we've got to slash and burn. And my first thought is the right loves to use kitchen table economics. I don't necessarily agree, but they love to use that. So in your household, how would you react? And, you know, the question pops up in my head. You know, how many people are more than 90% in debt, and is it ruining their GDP? Is it ruining their ability to grow? And how many corporations are more than 90% in debt? And, you know, if you think about your own situation. I know people who make $50,000 a year, they've got a $200,000 mortgage. I know people who are, you know, what is that? That's 400%, right? I know people who are, you know, make 50 grand, have a $100,000 mortgage. That's 200%, right? I mean, at the end of this, if you're going to use the kitchen table analogy, maybe use it. But this report that these two put out, what's interesting to me is now they're finding out that, well, it may not be what it was cracked up to be. And this is what happens when you have papers published that, well, don't have all of the methodology right out in front. And some believe that the problems with this paper is that they omitted a good bit of data that would have turned the conclusion the other way. They use some questionable statistical procedures. In fact, some people say highly, highly questionable. And the last one, you know, as we talked about the other night, they made, I guess, a basic Excel coding error, which, you know, people have looked for and figured out, and there's some serious questions to this 90% threshold. So now the question you have is, did we base an entire global set of policies based on something that was half-baked and cooked up? Did we basically crash most of Western Europe because of a failed ideology? Because of, you know, and this is one of those situations where I think you started with the answer and worked your way back to figure out how you got there. And you see that a lot on the right. You see that a lot in general. I think a lot of these think tanks, you know, they're funded by people who want a certain outcome. And they start at the outcome and work their way back to figure out how you get to these points. Because there are people who believe we should be selling everything government owns, and we should be slashing and burning all public investment and slashing and burning all social programs. All of it, done. You look here in Pennsylvania, we got a governor who wants to sell off the wine and spirit shop, sell off the lottery, sell off whatever they can while simultaneously gutting education, gutting healthcare, gutting public investment. You know, his own transportation commission says, yeah, we need all of the $2.5 billion a year. We need this massive investment. And what's he say? Well, 1.8 over the next 5 years. Because we need to be giving out huge tax breaks to corporations and handing money away. Not investing in the next generation. And look, it's bipartisan. You got Obama who's talking about selling off the Tennessee Valley Authority. So it seems to be bipartisan. They seem to have all bought into it. Okay, we need to. And the whole reason Obama wants to sell off the Tennessee Valley Authority in his budget, he says, well, to get us on the right fiscal path. It's the exact same theory, the exact same ideology, the exact same basis that they wanted to sell the wine and spirit shops last year. Oh, to fill our budget hole. We'll get billions of dollars and they'll fill our budget hole. Then when you look below, you peel that first layer of onion off, you go, well, no, this stinks. And at the end of it, what did we accomplish? I mean, look what we've done, and all the stories now coming out of what we've done to the next generation. Austerity has, I've been talking about austerity for years. It has only hit our shores for the last couple. Austerity has been something Latin America has known intimately for the last generation. Something Europe has been battling with for the last 20, 30 years. It's only now that it's become a word that we use and understand here. But it's been going on for years. And you look at what we've done to that next generation, like those college kids who are getting out going, uh-oh, I got $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $100,000 in student loan debt that I can never discharge, and I can't get a job that'll help me pay for it. So austerity has loaded them with massive debt, which is harming our economy and will seriously harm our economy for at least the next generation. And, you know, I think about when I got out of school, and you go, okay, well, I got a job that where I could, and I paid my student loans off in, I think it was like 2 or 3 years. That doesn't happen anymore. Because I think I got out, when I left school, I had like $4,500, $5,000 in student loan debt. You know, I know people now, 30, 40, 50,000 for an undergrad degree. And you go, really? Well, what kind of job did you get? Oh, I got a job working at TJ Maxx, or I got a job working at some big box retailer, or a rent-a-car place. I'm going, really? Can you make a living at that? Well, no, I can't pay my loans. Which is why there's a push, and I think a push that needs to happen. Right now, there's a bill in front of the House, the Student Loan Fairness Act, that some are saying, you know, maybe this is the way forward, where you have a 10-10 repayment plan, where you pay 10% of your discretionary income, not 10% of your total income, for 10 years, and limit the interest capitalization to 10% of the original principal, and say, okay, education is for the benefit of society, and we're going to make sure that there's money available, but we're not going to let the investor class rob the next generation. Because think about that. You're talking about $1.1 trillion in student loan money that has gone into this system, and who benefits from it? Well, you got large investors who are benefiting from these kids just wanting a middle-class existence because they've been sold. The only way that you get into the middle class, the only way you get a decent job, is you have to pay a whole bunch of money and invest a whole ton of money in the hope, in the prospects that maybe, possibly, there's going to be something at the end of the road. And the sad reality is, for too many college graduates, it's not there. So when I look at this, I say there's so many things we've got to be talking about, and austerity is at the heart of it. This idea that we don't have money to invest, this idea that we're broke. Without asking the question, well, if we are broke, where'd all the money go? And we know where it went. Up. Went to the very wealthy. We have created the largest billionaire class in the history of civilization. And how did we do that? Well, by $1.1 trillion on the back of college students, by defunding public education, putting 30, 40, 50 kids in a classroom, by not funding a public sector pensions. Because, oh, well, your times are great. We didn't raise taxes. Vote for us. Well, look at the crisis that mentality has brought us. It just is what it is. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, and talk about voting. There's a piece of legislation that I'm hoping gets passed through, making voter registration that much easier. But you know what? I think we could make it better. Right back. Stick around.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Investigators are trying to determine the cause of what may be the most deadly industrial explosion in Texas since the Texas City plant, Jesse Russell reports.
In the Texas City incident, 15 workers were killed and more than 170 injured after a vapor cloud explosion. Both external and internal investigations after the Texas City explosion found that the plant had failed to investigate or act upon 8 overflows of the plant's relief system between 1994 and 2004. In 2012, an investigation of the West Fertilizer Plant by the U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration found ammonia tanks weren't properly labeled and that the company had plans to ship ammonia without following a security plan. The company was fined $10,000, but, as is common with federal citations, the company negotiated the fine down to $5,250 after taking corrective action. The plant was also fined by the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality in 2006 for failing to obtain or qualify for a permit. In a report reviewed by the Dallas Morning News, it was found that the company had told the Environmental Protection Agency that there was no risk of fire or explosion. The company said in the worst possible scenario, there could be a 10-minute release of ammonia gas, which would have no harmful effect on individuals.
If capitalism isn't working for you, you can always join the growing workers' co-op movement. Historian, activist, and author Gar Alperovitz, in his book, What Then Must We Do?, takes a look at the growing worker co-ops movement and the serious system changing that's possible when workers come together to create their own economic alternatives.
What's happening, mainly because the pain levels are growing so much, unemployment and difficulties around the country, people are setting up all kinds of co-ops, worker-owned companies, public banks, trying to move money to credit unions. There's a whole underground activity of democracy in action in the economy.
Alperovitz says some labor unions are embracing the worker co-op model.
The steelworkers, for instance, are advocating and helping set up co-ops and worker-owned companies, too. And that's a new development. In the 19th century, the Knights of Labor were doing that. But now steelworkers are doing it, and so is SEIU. We're beginning to see a trend as, you know, labor is beginning to look at creative new directions in ownership, too.
Families USA executive director Ron Pollack says with enrolled enrollment coming up in October for the Affordable Care Act's health exchanges, working middle class people will begin getting tax credits to subsidize health insurance premiums. The exchanges are being set up to make insurance more affordable for people who don't get it through their employers.
And these are very substantial tax credit subsidies. They will be in the thousands of dollars, and it is designed to reduce the out-of-pocket cost burden that people and families have purchasing health insurance.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done.
Had it passed, maybe had it gone into effect, maybe Mitt Romney would have won Pennsylvania, but he didn't. But that's not going to stop them. I guarantee that voter ID thing going to come back around in throughout the country. Anyway, I saw an interesting story. Senate Bill 37 passed 49-0 in the Senate, bipartisanship at its best, expanding the right to vote. I almost fell out of my chair. Sponsored by a Republican senator from Lancaster, Lloyd Smucker. Here to talk about the bill, I've got Andy Hoover, legislative director for the ACLU of Pennsylvania. Andy, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, you're welcome. It's good to talk about something positive.
Yeah, I mean, I saw this and I'm going, what? There's actual consensus that maybe we should be making voter registration easier? I'm missing something.
No, you're not missing something. That's exactly what the bill does. It requires the Department of State to create a system of online voter registration. And the way the bill works is the department would check you against either the PennDOT database, or you, if you don't have a PennDOT license or non-driving ID, include the last four digits of your Social Security number, and they go through the process the same way they do now with paper to verify that, yes, you are a citizen and you are eligible to vote. So it was a very positive thing to have happen. It's a modernization of the voter registration system, and it makes registering to vote easier.
I got to be honest, and just from a purely partisan standpoint, on my part, a Republican, this is his bill, and 49-0, all of them voted for it. Is there something in this that we should be watching out for?
Not at the moment, no. This was a system actually the Department of State had started to build, and it was actually close to being implemented last year. And then the day that the voter ID trial started, they made an announcement that they were not going to start the online voter registration system because counties had concerns about implementing both voter ID and this system.
Right.
So voter ID stopped something, besides the fact that voter ID itself is such a problem, it also stopped this positive program from moving forward. Now, one thing we are keeping an eye on is that some states restrict who can use online voter registration to only those who are currently in their Department of Motor Vehicles database. And that's the argument over voter ID all over again. We want to be sure this is a program that's accessible to all citizens.
Yeah, part of me goes, we should be registered. When guys fill out the selective services cards, they should be registered to vote. Everybody should be, my view is you should be registered, and if you want to opt out, that's your choice, but everyone should be registered. This whole idea of setting up all of these systems to me seems only like roadblocks to keep people from voting.
Yeah, I agree. You know, the IRS can track us down to pay our taxes, but we can't get everybody registered to vote. Go figure that. But I agree with you that, and that's one of the things we like about this system is that it expands the ability to register. The paper system will still exist because, of course, we want to be conscious of the digital divide and ensuring that people who don't have internet access can still register, which they can. The paper system will still exist. But this makes it easier. You know, if it's 10 o'clock at night the day before the registration deadline and you realize, oh, no, I need to register to vote, you go online, you register, you go to the department's website, and there you go, you're registered to vote.
Yeah, for me, the other part of this is you shouldn't have to worry about that deadline. If it's the night before voting and you haven't voted, you should be able to go the same day and register and cast your ballot. And that's just my view because, look, I know people lead busy lives, and, look, I know people have that digital divide. I just think we need to be making this as easy as possible.
Yeah, we agree. ACLU supports election day registration. You're right that registration itself can be a barrier because not only do you, right now in Pennsylvania, you can only vote on election day. We don't have early voting options. And you have the registration deadline. So there are multiple steps involved that keep the process from being simple. And when we make decisions about where we stand on voting issues, it always comes down to does this make the access to the vote easier? And simpler, and that's how we make decisions about what we do and do not support.
So now we're going to make it a little bit easier to register. How about making it a little easier to vote? I would like to see a week-long voting over two Saturdays and at least over two Saturdays. Since we're now coming into the 21st century, registering online, do you see some path to eventually voting online?
I don't know about voting online. That still requires a bit of research and development to ensure security. But in terms of early voting, yes, the ACLU supports early voting. It's just such a no-brainer. I know there's some implementation issues and some cost, but that can be overcome, as many states have shown. More than 30 states have some form of early voting, whether it's actual in-person early voting or it's no-excuse absentee balloting, meaning you can vote absentee without giving a reason, or both. Some states have both. So, those are initiatives that we support and we think are important for making it easier for people to vote. You know, the no-excuse absentee balloting, to me, is just so obvious. You know, right now in Pennsylvania, you have to assure your county that you anticipate being out of your district on election day for work purposes.
Yep.
Or you have to have some kind of disability issue that prevents you from getting to the poll, or a religious holiday. So it's a pretty narrow group of reasons why you can vote absentee.
Yeah, I went through it. You have to go down and sign the affidavit saying that you swear this to be honest, or crime, jail, locked up, fines.
Right.
Which seems ridiculous
exactly.
To me. I think if I want to vote absentee, because you know what? I work a 10 or 12 hour day on that Tuesday, and I've got kids I got to get on the bus and off the bus and things to do. You know, sometimes it's a Tuesday, man, and it's tough.
Yeah, well, and sometimes things happen. You know, people get sick. People, you know, you get in a fender bender on your way somewhere, and now your day is completely thrown off guard. Your kid gets sick. You know, things like that happen. And when the election happens on one day, it can prevent people from voting because of those kind of situations. I mean, in extreme situations, you know, someone's hospitalized, they can get an emergency absentee ballot, but it requires all kinds of work. With a judge and getting the person a ballot through the sheriff, and it's really involved, and you really have to be aware of the process. And even, like I said, the more minor situations, you know, you come down with flu, and how do you drag yourself to the polls, I guess. But with early voting, people have more options. And people have, you know, some people, of course, there's the economic issue of work. And the way work gets in the way, you know, I'm lucky that I have a job that's flexible and it's basically 9 to 5, and I can get to the polls. But, you know, as you know, a lot of working folk are working long hours or they're working two jobs. And how do you find time to get to the polls unless you have a friendly employer who will make sure that happens?
Yeah. And personally, I've always thought if you're not going to do the week long thing, it should be a holiday. We should be shutting everything down and giving people that opportunity. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Andy Hoover, Legislative Director for the Pennsylvania ACLU. You know, the other day I had seen a quote from the Secretary of State in Iowa, and he was telling this Tea Party group that they should love voter ID. He said, you know, you should tell your neighbors and your friends that you should start loving voter ID, because the only way, in his view, that they were going to be able to stop, you know, abortion and gay marriage and all of the social issues that they find so important was voter ID. I mean, basically saying, look, you know, we need to figure out how to suppress the vote.
Yeah, that's that certainly, there's an undercurrent of that in the whole voter ID discussion. I mean, the flip side of it from a positive perspective for us is our reason for taking our position and fighting the bill first and now taking it to court is that it keeps people from voting, and we want as many people as possible being involved in the voting process, and whether or not they have a PennDOT issued ID should not impact their ability to vote. This system has worked fine in Pennsylvania for a couple hundred years, and there's no evidence of fraud, and so the arguments against the voter ID are obvious. But you're right. I mean, there is certainly that more cynical bunch in the on the other side who support voter ID, who recognize it for what it really is, and occasionally they let slip of the tongue and they show their true motivation.
Yeah, I mean, and for me, it's one of those things where, you know, if it were a problem and you could show me a couple of cases that were documented, I looked at the trial last year. They said there wasn't a documentable case. They didn't know of any cases. And in fact, there was a study done in Wisconsin that found the voter fraud rate to be at 0.0002%. In fact, you had a better chance of being struck by lightning twice than finding anyone who committed voter fraud.
Right, and even then, even when you find those situations, sometimes they're not nearly as nefarious as people think. You know, there was a story in one of the York papers last year, I believe, maybe 2 years ago, about some irregularities in voting, and one guy accidentally signed on the line for his deceased father. You know, he wasn't intending to vote twice. He just accidentally signed. Their names were right next to each other, and he accidentally signed next to his father's name, and his father had passed away recently. So, you know, those kind of things happen. Unfortunately, the other side wants to raise the boogeyman of voter ID as if voter fraud as if elections are hinging on it, and clearly it's not. And in fact, as you said, as you referenced, the Commonwealth itself admitted they have no evidence of in-person voter fraud.
Let me ask you a last line of questioning, because the election last year, the voter ID was not in place. I understand this next election season going to be in place. Explain how that's going to work.
We don't know that yet. It's actually off for the primary next month. There will be no ID requirements, although your poll workers may ask you for it or may give you information about it. It'll be basically the same as it was in November. The trial is scheduled for July, and this will be the final decision. Well, not the court itself, not the Commonwealth Court, but this will be the last leg of deciding up or down on voter ID. Presumably it goes to the state Supreme Court. So there will be a trial on its constitutionality. Everything that happened last year was for the purpose of delaying it for the November election.
Right.
And what we're doing now is taking it to court to have it permanently overturned. So the trial starts in July, mid-July.
Well, they'll give us something else to talk about as we move forward, as this issue doesn't seem to die. I mean, you know, it's one of the ALEC pieces of legislation. The moneyed interest want it, and it's curious as to why.
No, you're absolutely right. And our continued position and continued work is protecting people's rights to vote, and that's exactly what we're going to do.
I appreciate it. I appreciate your time, Andy. Thanks so much.
All right, thanks, Rick. See you.
Andy Hoover, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Pennsylvania. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. From the talk.
We got to get organized. We got to do it today. No more madness to do. No more mystery. We got to get organized.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at CapBlueCross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events. deaths, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Of benefit autism. Get on board features custom one-of-a-kind artwork on skateboard decks from nationally renowned tattoo artists and fine artists. All proceeds go directly to the Autism Society Greater Harrisburg area. The initial public showing will be during the Derby Inc. Invitational Tattoo Convention at the Farm Show Complex, April 19th through 24th. Visit facebook.com/ get on board for autism. facebook.com/ get on board for autism. Sponsored by Razor Tattoos.
Let's have a tea party. It'd be great. It'd be grand. It'd be wonderful. As long as we can exclude those people and take their cookies. And I love that. I love that whole, you know what? Those poor people are taking your cookies when it's the very wealthy who've taken the whole plate. A couple of crumbs left, and you could fight over those. And, well, it just is what it is. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Interesting story on the voting front. I look at Oregon. Like I said, Oregon's their Secretary of State is leading this effort to expand voting to everyone. And, you know, I've always scratched my head going, you know, why do you have to go through this whole registration process if it's my right as a citizen? You know, if you remember Iraq, everybody showed up, put their finger on the little ink pad, and, hey, I went and voted today. No photo ID, none of that. They were present. They put their finger on the thing there. They voted. We went to war. We spent spent a couple trillion dollars to make sure that they were well taken care of. No, we're not going to do that at home. But in Oregon, the Secretary of State there, she wants to expand the opportunity of folks to vote. Not by making registration easier, but by making it automatic. So the second you get a driver's license, so you apply for a driver's license, boom, you're automatically registered as a voter in the state of Oregon. And then, and this is one of those things where you go, this seems the way it should be. Okay, you sign up, you vote, register to vote. They send you a registration, say, okay, you've been registered as an independent voter. You can choose to, you know, make a party affiliation. You want to be a Democrat, a Republican, a Green, a Libertarian, whatever. You can opt for that. Or you can opt out. I don't want to vote. The heck with it. I don't want to participate. System's broken. Seems rational to me. And what they're saying in Oregon is that about 500,000 people are eligible to vote that aren't registered voters. And these people are already in the DMV database. So The second they pass this, bang, there's 500,000 more voters who can go to the polls. And, you know, I look at this and go, that's a great idea. Now, the other part of it is a lot of people don't have driver's license. And that's another problem. But on this thing, just the people on the DMV rolls who aren't eligible voters right now because they're not registered, expanding it to 500,000 more people to give them the opportunity seems rational to me. Now, the Republicans there in the state of Oregon, not happy. The Republican Party's executive director, a guy named Greg Leo, he thinks it's a bad idea because that's just going to allow stupid people to come vote. Well, that's not what he said. He said, we make it so easy for people to participate that I worry they won't take the time to be an informed voter and to really study the issues. So when I hear that, I go, you know how many misinformed people I talk to who pull the lever for George W. Bush? You know how many misinformed voters I've talked to who pulled the lever for Mitt Romney? Are we talking about actually testing voters now? That's something Republicans would really love to do. Look, you take the good with the bad. You have the right to vote. There are some people who are extremely informed, and there are some people who are extremely over-misinformed. And then you have some that, well, you know, just going to go pull the lever because that's my right. And I've always been a supporter of the idea of, you know what? That's part of being a citizen. It's part of being, you can't complain unless you pull the lever. You can't complain unless you've made a choice. And for too many of us, the default choice is we're going to do nothing and complain about both sides. Complain about no matter what happens, and we don't get involved. Now, there is something to this idea that you can sway people based on advertising. You can sway people, based on misinformation. And there was an interesting study done in Sweden that the researchers have called choice blindness. They're saying it's exploiting this known defect in our psychology. And they've written this piece in the Journal of PLOS-1, where they found 162 voters to fill out surveys on their views on key issues. You know, the things that they found important, like taxes or energy, actual issues, not that social stuff but just key issues. Like that. Not the social stuff, but the economic and the tax stuff like that. And what they did is once they got these surveys filled out, they switched them. And they put on the form the exact opposite answers. And then they went back to these people and said, hey, why did you vote? Why did you write this down? Why did you do this? Why is this your view? Why are you against raising taxes when you wrote on the other one that you were for them? But they didn't say that. What they said is, hey, you know, we got your survey and you said you're against raising taxes. Now, they had originally written down that they were for raising taxes or the other way around. And when they were confronted with it, 92%, and this just blows my mind, 92% of the people didn't catch that their answers were changed. Only 22% of these switched answers were noticed by participants. So you got 92% of the people who they didn't even know that the answers had been changed. They believed the survey taker. 22% were, wow, I must have made a mistake. 10% actually, this is amazing to me. 10% actually switched their political preference. And 19% became undecided, which is pretty interesting. The researchers found that a full 47% of the people that they surveyed were open to changing their vote, which I got to be honest, you know, gives me some hope that you can talk to people. And if you lay it out and say, this is the reality, this is how things, there's a hope for me that if you hear something long enough, you have this opinion that came to you, and it's not really something hard felt, but there's an opportunity to talk to people and change hearts and minds based on reality. Now, this theory, this research that's been done in the past on choice blindness has been, you know, basically focused on, you know, what you find attractive in a mate, some moral values, products, a lot of product placement stuff. Personally, you know, I've always been fairly brand specific, and I guess you could bring this back into voting and make it look just like, you know, if you bought this kind of soup. I've been very brand specific throughout my life with certain things. You got to wonder, if they put a label on something else that was similar, would you know the difference? And there's part of me that goes back to our political process. Democrats, Republicans switch the labels half the time. There's not much difference, which is why there's the other part of me that says we need to be organizing and standing on firmer ground. Anyway, gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
That's the wonky phrase attached to an elegant idea. Namely, converting communities to total renewable energy, complete recycling, and a culture of conservation to bring humankind's carbon footprint into a sustainable balance with a healthy earth. Now, imagine the least likely place you'd expect this ideal to take root and even flourish. How about an army base? In Texas, no less. Astonishingly, America's net zero future is being pioneered at Fort Bliss, a sprawling military base of 35,000 soldiers in El Paso. The post already has a 1.4 megawatt solar array and has placed rooftop solar panels on all base housing, generating 13.4 megawatts of energy. And it's in partnership with El Paso Electric to add a 200-acre 20 megawatt solar farm by 2015. It also has a plan to convert post waste into energy, is engaged in wind power, geothermal, and conservation projects, is promoting energy-efficient vehicles, and is building bicycle lanes. The Army. Who knew they cared? Bliss's rank-and-file soldiers, as well as the brass, are committed to achieving the goal of net zero by 2018, meaning the base will generate all the energy it uses, and do it with renewables. Adding to the effort, the troops have planted nearly 15,000 trees and have become converts to recycling. To encourage the latter, the base commander, General Dana Pittard, has put $1 million a year revenue from recycling into skating parks, exercise facilities, and other morale-boosting recreation projects. It's fostering a conservation culture, hoping that the soldiers will take it with them when they go on. This is Jim Hightower saying, there's hope for the earth when even the Army begins to change.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Friday, April 19th, the Lyrid meteor shower is expected to strengthen throughout the weekend, and the peak numbers will probably fall in the pre-dawn hours this Monday, April 22nd. Even at its peak, though, this modest shower oftentimes offers no more than 10 to 20 meteors per hour.
In an uncanny bit of bad timing, the illuminated portion of the moon will increase in size as this year's Lyrid meteor shower picks up steam. You'll probably have to work around the moon for an optimal viewing window. In fact, it might be better to watch the Lyrid meteors before dawn over the next few days, instead of waiting for the peak date, because the moon will set earlier and will provide more moon-free darkness before dawn.
The most Lyrid meteors tend to fly from about 3 a.m. local time until dawn's first light. The moon will set a few hours before dawn throughout the weekend, leaving some dark sky for observing these fast-moving and sometimes surprisingly bright meteors.
The Lyrids are notorious for defying easy forecasting. Unexpected outbursts pushed the rates to 90 meteors per hour in 1982, 100 meteors per hour in 1922, and 700 meteors per hour in 1803.
You never know for sure what you'll get with a Lyrid shower. For the next several days, you can find out for yourself in the darkness between moonset and dawn. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice of science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So starting on June 8th, we're going to be heading out to San Jose for Netroots Nation on our big bus tour, the Great American Family Road Trip, or the Great History Tour. We're going to be discovering, and this really, the genesis of this came because the History Channel did this series of the men who built America or the men who made America great or whatever the title was, basically focusing on the robber barons of the past. And what they did was, is they said, hey, you know, we're going to talk to robber barons of the present so that we can get the robber barons, give credo to the robber barons of the past and say how they were the ones who built everything. They're the ones who did all of this work. They're the ones that the people with their names on things. You know, like the bridge, it has some guy's name on it who didn't put down anything. Probably couldn't find it on a map. The buildings that have people's name, we look down here at the hospital, it's got some guy's name on it. He just donated a couple of bucks to put his name on it. He didn't actually build the building. And those are the things that we need to remember. The people who built this country, the people who made this country great, are actually the people who built it. You, me, all of the other people, my grandparents. Every day we're told, oh, it's these at the top. I'm saying, fundamentally, I disagree with that. Fundamentally, I disagree with the concept that a handful of people are the ones who built this country because they had ideas. You might have an idea, but you still need someone who knows how to do it. You may say, I'd love to build a huge skyscraper. Yeah? Well, the guy who was up 500 feet off the ground, 1,000 feet off the ground, 2,000 feet off the ground building that building, that's the guy who built it. And we're going to go across country and we're going to find places that I think are significant to the history of the labor movement, of work in this country, to workers, to you and me, and we're going to talk about it. We're going to go all across the country and find places where as we head out to Netroots Nation that I think are important that I'm going to show my kids. Because labor education, the history of the working class, the history of we the people has been stripped from our history books, has been stripped from education, it's been stripped from, absolutely stripped from K-12 education. And in the higher ed world, we're seeing labor education centers that used to be in universities all across the country being stripped out. And why? For a couple of bucks. Something seriously wrong. You know, we're going to go to places like Memphis, Tennessee, and talk about the sanitation strike. Talk about JFK. Talk about, you know, the fight for economic justice. You know, I mean, that whole movement has been pigeon-toed. Wow, it was just about giving African Americans equal rights. No, it was about equal rights for everybody. It was about socioeconomic justice for everybody. And it's a fight we need to have again. So when I look at this whole tour focuses around how we built the middle class, how we built this nation, and how we come together in times of tragedy, how we come together to do things that we need. We're going to head out to the Hoover Dam. I want my kids to be able to see that. We built that. Public investment, public will, we built that. We're going to see the highs. We're going to see the lows. When we go through Salt Lake City, Utah, definitely have to go to the place where Joe Hill was murdered. Trumped up charges. Sat him on a white kitchen chair, firing squad, murdered him. And we're going to go through places like Toledo, Ohio, to look at who built the glass industry. You know, I was talking to a friend. I asked him, when you think of Toledo, Ohio, what do you think of? Well, right now what people think of is part of the Rust Belt, the deindustrialization. The same thing with Detroit or Cleveland or any of those parts. It's all the deindustrialization. It's the globalization that brought us companies fleeing this nation. But when I was a kid, glass, Toledo meant glass. Akron meant rubber. Pittsburgh meant steel. Detroit meant autos. All that stuff's been stripped away. And when you go to a place like Toledo, you're going to go, hey, where'd the glass go? Because they just erected a museum, like a big monument museum to the glass, to the history of the glass industry. And ironically, and I guess it's telling, which I want to go see and I can't wait to see, the glass for this glass monument to Toledo's past, produced in China. There's something to that. And for me, there's a lot to this. It's about educating my kids. It's about educating myself. It's about educating the public as we're going to do this across country with the radio show. We're going to do videos. We're writing a couple of books as we go, because I think it's vitally important to have this conversation. Who did build this country? Who did make this country great? Instead of relying on, well, the History Channel said it was you know, the robber barons, the Carnegies, the Mellons, the Vanderbilts, you know, the Goulds, all of them. It was them. No. It was us. You know, you think about the railroad industry. You know, how'd the railroad industry prop up? Well, a lot of money from government, a lot of land theft, a lot of wage exploitation, a lot of that. Who built it? People who sacrificed on those lines. People who lost land. People who lost part of their community. You know, just so many things that I want to do. And I'd love to hear your input, thoughts, comments. What would you like to hear us put out as we go across the country? There's a lot of opportunities. We're going to run across 40 along the bottom, the southern part of the country, and see that area, how it was built up, What I mean, we're going to go through Little Rock, and you can't go through Little Rock, Arkansas, without stopping at Central High School to talk about education. You can't go through Oklahoma City without talking about the Murrah Building and the bombing there and the first responders and the community and all of that stuff. I mean, these are rich stories that I think need to be told from a working class perspective. We get an awful lot of, you know, the wealthy guy came in and donated some money. But we don't really hear the stories of the folks at the bottom, the folks who, the ones who are struggling, people like you and me. And that's why I want to use this opportunity, not only to do this for the program, but also for my kids, so that they have a different perspective than what they're being told in school, that they have an opportunity to think and to see and to learn. Because I truly believe the best learning happens when you're doing. The best learning happens through experiential purposes, where you get your hands dirty, where you trip and you fall, or whatever. To me, that's what's exciting. And we're looking forward to it. If you've got any thoughts, any comments, I'd love to hear it. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Cannot wait. Going to take a quick break. Back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
7 Florida teachers are suing the state over a 2011 law that they allege is violating their constitutional right to due process and equal protections. The complaint claims that by eliminating tenure for new teachers, but not for older teachers, it creates an unequal class system in the schools. Additionally, Under the law, job performance is gauged partially by standardized tests, and those tests can include information that teachers didn't teach in the class. For example, the standardized test could include testing on math topics that the teacher being judged hasn't taught in her classroom. The Florida Education Association also joined the lawsuit, which was filed Tuesday in Gainesville Federal Court. The ALCIO is substantially expanding its non-union worker program. Doug Cunningham reports.
Working America, the AFL-CIO community affiliate consisting of non-union workers, is expanding to all 50 states in the U.S. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka told The Nation magazine that Working America has recruited more than 3 million people who aren't in unions to join the labor movement. Working America Executive Director Karen Nussbaum says the expansion into all 50 states will also mean beginning to organize in workplaces. Working America plans to double its number of state chapters over 3 years, with the goal of having chapters in every state by 2018. Nussbaum told The Nation magazine she wants to give workers the tools they need to get into motion at the workplace and in communities. She said labor leaders have told her they need Working America in every state. Working America is supported financially by the AFL-CIO, but the organization is working on economic self-sufficiency as it expands the number of chapters around the country.
More Republic Allied Waste workers have gone on strike, charging the company with unfair labor practices. Workers in Memphis and Millington, Tennessee, stopped collecting recycling, alleging that Republic unilaterally cut wages without negotiating with a union representing those workers. According to the Teamsters, some workers saw their paychecks slashed by upwards of $200. The strike follows workers in Georgia walking off the job Monday, alleging that Republic has refused to bargain fairly over a contract. Additionally, workers in Youngstown began an unfair labor practice strike on March 27th. Republic workers in other areas of the country have also stopped work in solidarity with those currently making the unfair labor practice charges. Strikes have been reported in Washington State, Arkansas, Mississippi, and Indiana.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So in looking at Governor Corbett's Twitter page, he points out that today he was in Philadelphia to welcome Horizon Lines freight shipping company to the ports of Philadelphia. I wonder how much tax dollars, how many tax dollars we gave out there. He said the move will help create an estimated 400 full-time direct and indirect jobs at the port. I wonder how many are direct, if he's making that distinction. Also, he claims it's going to bring $3 million in tax revenue. So he's back from his trip through, Rio and, through Brazil and Chile, brought 74 jobs back while we're losing, over 1,000 in Erie. Now he comes back and says, hey, 400 jobs here in the port. While he's cost us in education cuts more than 20,000 education professional jobs. And I'm looking down the road at some of the other cuts that are coming could be more. And we've talked about what's going on in Philadelphia with the school district and the negotiations with the teachers. Just blows the mind what the school district's asking for. In fact, the numbers could cost upwards of 3,000 more jobs. So good job, Governor. You brought in 400 that you probably stole from somewhere else while we're losing another 3,000 teachers. Great. Way to go, buddy. That's why I've asked Hillary Lirinopoulos, a Philadelphia fourth grade teacher, to come talk to us about the negotiations and what's going on down there in Philadelphia. Hillary, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, Rick. How are you doing?
I am good. You know, I'm looking at this, and 400 jobs you're bringing in, but in the school district, I've heard rumors, what, 3,000 could be lost?
Yeah, that was a bombshell that came out today. 3,000 jobs could be lost next year.
And,
I mean, schools essentially would be running with principals, just one principal per school, no matter the size, and the bare-bones essential teachers that are required by law, and that's it.
I mean, to me, that sounds like a recipe for disaster. But I should know it is a recipe for disaster, because the way I see it going on in Philadelphia, what they're trying to do is privatize the whole system, move everything into either for-profits or into charters.
Right. Right. It is. I mean, it's a recipe for disaster, but it's at this stage, it's unbelievable to me, because I don't actually see how you could possibly cut any more than you've already cut. I have, this year in my class, I have 8 more kids than I had last year in my class, and we are getting several hundred students more next year in our school.
Wow.
Because of a neighboring school that's closing. So we're a receiving school, and we're going to have several hundred more kids and significantly fewer resources. I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
How many kids do you have in your class this year?
At the moment, 26, which is actually not so bad. But we had really small classes last year, and we were able to do a lot more.
Yeah, I mean, I've got 3 kids. I have a hard enough time keeping them still for 30 minutes, let alone an entire day. I can't imagine what it's like to have 26 or 27. Or, you know, I look at that school in Detroit, Michigan, that was cited by the fire marshal for having 52 kids in a kindergarten class.
Yep.
Is
and
that
that's
where
the
we're
thing,
heading?
That's the thing that we're thinking maybe is only that will be our leverage next year is building safety code. I was telling some of my colleagues, well, maybe we're going to, you know, if they're going to cancel the class cap sizes, because that's part of the contract that they're seeking to eliminate class cap requirements. So that's one of the asks. So I said, well, maybe we can actually fight this based on building code and square footage. And it's sick that we're having to think that way.
I mean, the sad reality is, you know, I look at that school in Detroit. There was barely enough room in that classroom for the kids to trip over each other.
Right, absolutely. Yep. That's the reality. And, I mean, with the kindergartners having 30 kids in a class, I mean, that's
warehousing.
Silly.
That's just warehousing is what it is.
Yep, yep.
And what frustrates me is, you know, I see all of this money being spent on advertising for charters. I see all this money spent on a George W. Bush presidential library, some $500 million they raised for a guy who could barely hold the book My Pet Goat. And yet I look in the contract that they've offered you, no librarians.
Right. Well, I mean, there are very, very few librarians already. I mean, that's the thing. When I heard this budget, it was one thing if we had all of these superfluous things and we had all these extracurriculars and we had sports and we had librarians and we had enough counselors and nurses. We don't already. We have one counselor for 600-some kids, and she's required to do high school applications, regular counseling, and it's, you know, that's, she's so thin. So next year they're going to just eliminate all counselors. They would just be gone.
So what happens to what they used to do? It just, the kids just don't get it?
It becomes somebody else's responsibility.
So then what you're saying is it just doesn't happen.
Well, it depends. I mean, we've added a lot onto our own personal plates as the years have passed, and I think that's just out of we feel a moral responsibility to go above and beyond. And so we do, and I think that in a way we end up shooting ourselves in the foot with that, because then they say, well, look, you can do that. You know, you can do more. You absolutely can. I was doing work until 10 minutes before you called.
Jeez. But you have that cushy job. It's 7 hours a day, summer's off, weekends
right.
off. It's a cushy job.
Of course, absolutely.
And you make you make huge money with gilded pensions and all of that stuff. What are you complaining about?
Yes, with a 13% pay cut looming and the 13% contribution to health care and I was flabbergasted when I read everything tonight, and I wasn't. I don't know why I was, because I guess we know the money is lacking. But I just thought surely somebody will see that you actually physically can't operate buildings like that.
Well, let me ask you this, Hillary. You said the money's lacking. Is the money lacking, or is it just being poorly allocated? Because, you know, I look at all the money that we seem to have for charter schools and for the consultants who run the charter schools. We seem to have a ton of money for that. We have a ton of money for advertising. We have a ton of money for, you know, cyber charters and all of this stuff. Is it that we don't have it, or we're poorly allocating it? Or is it both?
I think that it's both. And I think that in the district, we were really poorly managed for a long time, and there was a lot of money that was really, really poorly spent, and we were up in arms about it, and we were trying to make noise about it, but we were under a teachers were very, very scared to talk and to complain, and I do see that dynamic shifting a little bit, which I think
so.
Is a positive thing. I really do see that as positive, and I do think that our voices are being heard more. So I think that it's unfair to say there is enough money and we just have to do a better job with it, because, you know, of course, it goes back to, well, what were they doing in the previous years? They really messed us up for a long time.
Well, with the goal of privatizing it, I mean, it's to me, I look at cities like Philadelphia or my hometown of Cleveland or Detroit or Milwaukee or any of these places where these charters have sprung up, and they've all followed the same path. They've given their tax base away. They've created and manufactured this enormous budget crisis. And they go, oh, well, it's broken. We got to bring in corporate money. Corporate money comes in and says, oh, we got to get rid of these public school teachers because they're too uppity. We need to bring in exploitable charter teachers. And look, there's nothing. No problem with people who work at a charter school.
Right.
Get a voice. Stand up and fight for yourself. I mean, for me, I wish more teachers were like the image of Teamsters on TV, because we absolutely need people who are going to go to the streets and stand up and say, enough, I've got to advocate for my kids. I got to advocate for the system as a whole.
Right, right. And that's essential. That's what I see as my essential role as an advocate for my students, and that's what I'll continue to do. I'm not out there advocating for my paycheck. I'm not out there advocating. I'm not really asking anybody to even contribute more for supplies for my classroom. I'm not, because I know that's part of the gig, and I
but it shouldn't
accept
be
that.
Hillary.
But,
it shouldn't be.
You know, my job is to advocate for my students, 26 kids in North Philadelphia, living in conditions that if Governor Corbett dared to walk into their houses, he would probably actually be shocked. And that doesn't mean that they don't have good parents. That doesn't mean that they don't have parents that are not trying their hardest to do what they can for their, you know, their most prized possession is their child. But yet we fail them, and they have no voice, and they're in this little bubble in North Philadelphia, and nobody outside of the neighborhood wants to hear or thinks that they have anything to offer. So my ultimate goal as an educator is to expose the good, the great things that happen in this tiny neighborhood in West Kensington, North Philadelphia, you know, and to show people that these kids are actually not those children. They're our kids, and they're worth it.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, you know, it's like any of, you know, when I played any sports, I mean, the idea of, you know, the weakest link, the one who's the weakest link, that's how well we're going to do, and how we treat the most vulnerable in our society is how our nation's going to go. If we allow our kids in West Philadelphia, or a kid on the, like me, growing up on the west side of Cleveland, to fall behind and to fail, our entire nation is going to fall behind.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they already are, we already are failing our children with lacking resources. I mean, we had a program last year at our school that was just phenomenal. A woman who was from an outside agency but partnered with the school district, and she was basically a liaison between families and social services. So we could refer a child to her for basically anything. You know, if I suspected that a child had some mental health issues, even physical health issues, you know, dental care, if I thought that, you know, outside tutoring would help the child, she could sit with that parent. She would go to their house. She would sit with them at their house. She would basically do an intake survey for all the kids, you know, see what exactly was the missing piece in making this child successful.
See, that's
and she
answer.
Would be an awesome liaison between, and she would reach out to agencies that we're not really allowed to as teachers. And, you know, then she was gone. And that was that. And that program was no more, and the kids who were working with her had no idea where she went and
just disappeared.
Disappeared.
And that's the problem. That's the problem with a lot of poor school districts. There's no stability. There's no cohesiveness. There's no continuity. And to me, when you start pulling money out and you defund these schools, that's what you end up with. And the sad thing is these kids they're growing up in unstable environments. They're growing up in places where they don't have that consistency. And to continue that in the education process just reinforces that insecurity.
Right. And that's the, you know, there's a group of my coworkers and I have been at the school for a while, and that's one of the things that we often say that it's so, so important that the kids have faces that they've seen for years and years and years. And they have people that they can know that will be there, but they don't have enough of them, and they don't have, and I can't provide my kids with everything that they need. I can't provide them with outside counseling. I can't diagnose mental illness. I can't provide them therapy for mental illness. You know, things like that they actually, they need.
Yeah.
And there isn't enough of. And we're already in this completely strapped situation. We heard last year from the district that they knew that they couldn't hit schools anymore, that it was just that schools were like already cut to the bone, so they were going to find other places to cut. And now I don't know how you can cut more.
Well, let me ask you last line of questioning here, and looking at this offer that the district has made, is this just not a way to get? Because from the beginning, when I looked at it, I said this is a recipe to get the teachers to go out on strike, so you can then get rid of all of them and charterize everything. Is there any thought that's potentially the idea behind this? Because I look at the number of things that are in this, and there's a ton of things. I can't go through every one of them right now, but there's a ton of things that are just right from the beginning, in my view, non-starters, like teachers not being able to defend themselves, not having water fountains, not having a break area, not having desks or books or you name it. To me, it just looked like it was so objectionable that they were trying to force teachers to go out on strike.
Well, I mean, we're, as you probably know, under Act 46, we theoretically can't strike. And that's what they hold on to, I think, that under the state takeover law, which only applies to Philadelphia, we're not allowed to strike. Now, that's never been tested in the court. So that remains to be seen. I think that the initial contract offer is probably designed somewhat to counsel people into retirement or resignation, and then that way it's easier to say that they did not have as many layoffs as they anticipated. Because if people are resigning, then they didn't get laid off. That's one facet of it. And I think with the budget situation that came out today, I do think that part of it is to put the pressure on the state primarily to, you know, give the funding that has been asked. So I do think that that's a huge chunk of it, but I think that a lot of it is not scare tactics from everything I'm reading, that it's actually real stuff that could happen
and
is likely to happen and is frightening.
And what's sad about that is, you know, as you said there a second ago, you're going to see a lot of people leaving the profession.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to me, that's just that spiraling downward. As I've been saying, this crisis that's being created so that they can just say, see, we need to privatize the whole system because corporations can come in and take care of it. That's my fear.
Right. And I mean, I think that we need to shift shift the conversation about these failing schools, and we need to, I wish the people at the top would stop saying it's all about the kids, because it seems like such empty rhetoric.
No, it's really all about the money.
Yeah, and it, I mean, when I say it's all about my kids, I mean it's all about my kids. I don't mean it's all about those kids in North Philadelphia, West Kensington. Those kids, you know, that, you know, people say, oh, you do such a noble thing teaching those kids. I don't think it's a noble thing. It's my profession. It's what I love to do.
Yep.
And I don't see it as charity work. And when we start seeing educating our kids as charity work, and so we think, in other words, any little thing that we provide them is, well, it's better than what they would have otherwise. No, this is not charity. This is real life. This is our future. These are our kids, and we have to step up and stop looking at them as a charity project.
I'm right there with you. I couldn't agree more. Hillary, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the passion. Thank
My
you so
pleasure.
Much.
My pleasure. Anytime.
All righty. I appreciate
All right,
it.
All right.
Thank
thanks, you. Rick. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All righty. Hillary Leonardopoulos, fourth grade teacher there in Philadelphia. It's a horrible situation down there. Let's take a quick break back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Save the USA and resume the ties it binds. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job that you're looking for.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Hi, my name is Ethan. My dad is a sanitation worker at Republic Services. My dad spends a lot of time away from home doing the fourth most dangerous job in America, but he is invisible at work, and Republic Services does not treat him with the respect he deserves. Support us on Facebook at facebook.com/Republic Services Teamsters. Thank you.
Earth Day cometh. The 43rd year of this national focus on our globe. Should we weep or cheer? Both. The first step toward any recovery is admitting that we have a problem. In fact, beaucoup of them. For example, despite the squawking of profiteering polluters and professional deniers, our very atmosphere, without which everyone and everything is dead, is rapidly being degraded by our addiction to fossil fuels, literally altering Earth's climate in disastrous ways. Yet, as we burn, our policymakers fiddle. Let us fiddle with the tar sands in Alberta, Canada, they demand, uncaring about the vast amounts of ozone-destroying carbon that will be released by ripping open the boreal forest to get at the junk oil, or about the extra carbon dioxide contamination that will come from processing this especially toxic sludge. Also, let us fiddle with the earth itself by fracking deep underground shale to bring gas, oil, and ozone-depleting methane to the surface. Oh, and let us keep fiddling with the priceless ecology of America's ancient Appalachian mountains by exploding off the mountaintops, merely to make it cheaper for big coal to extract more ozone-killing ore. There are plenty of horrors to make you weep on this Earth Day, but tears don't bring change. That comes only from the determined effort of ordinary grassroots people to organize, strategize, and mobilize. The good news for our Earth and our own existence is that such people are on the move in every part of America. They're confronting the greedheads and boneheads, creating effective energy alternatives, forging fresh and sensible policies, lifting heads out of the sand, and producing the change we must have. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's what Earth Day is about. Don't weep. Cheer the progress we've made. And join the movement for more.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Fox News alert, it's election day, and we got some new video we just showed you of a member of the new Black Panther Party standing guard outside a polling place in Philadelphia.
Standing guard. No, he was actually opening the door for for little old lady, but that doesn't make for stereotyping, does it? Not so much. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Found this interesting little tidbit over at the crowdsourcing website, Indiegogo.com. I love this. Technology, they write, engages students and gets them excited about learning. You can help us get started. Tech to Educate is a registered 501c3 nonprofit organization. Their mission, gotta love the mission, Tech to Teach provides teachers and students in independent public schools, such as charter schools, with up-to-date technology and software to engage the student in the classroom and enhance a student's educational experience. Why not all students? Why just charter school students? We don't know who's behind Tech to Educate yet. I'm looking, hoping to find out, but it's interesting to me that it's only charter schools. Independent public schools, not public schools run by we the people. No. The ideological schools. They say what we need. What they need are 30 iPads at about $400 a piece. They need $12,000. It's going to go directly to the charter school in Philadelphia. They are partnering with KIPP, which we've talked about in the past. They said that, you know, they've got some that they've allocated for their first project, but they want to do more. And they need new organizations, and they have volunteers, because the project's underway. Founded in Philadelphia, Tech to Teach has a tremendous group of charter schools to work with, and that number is constantly growing. Students and teachers need more technology in the classroom to make learning fun and exciting. And again, I go back to this. I get the idea that we want to get tablets and we want to get iPads into the hands of kids so they learn. Because you know what? That's their technology. That's their future. That's what they're going to need. So my question is, why in the hell do we need a group like this to only give them to charter schools? This is what's going on with education. We are dividing this up by saying, oh, well, we'll fund and we'll get things into the hands of the charter schools, but the rest of you, be damned. Why aren't we investing heavily in education? Why do we have to have these crowdsourcing events? And correct me if I'm wrong. Don't we already have a crowdsourcing mechanism for education? It's called taxes. It's called paying the taxes for the local schools so our kids learn, the next generation does well, right? I mean, because I thought we'd figured this stuff out pretty well, because I think I did pretty well up until I went to high school. Thought it was pretty reasonable. And I look at this article that I found the other day that just fits right in with this. We're rebranding education. We're redoing it. We don't need public schools. No, we got charters. We've got these different things. I read this article that really just grabbed my attention over at the National Journal. And it's talking about the New Orleans school. Because you remember, after Hurricane Katrina came through, they basically fired every teacher in the district and brought in all of these Teach for America people working 80, 90 hours a week in these charter schools and these private schools. And understand that the schools are divided. The white middle class goes to the private schools that give the vouchers and all of that. And then the majority black students end up in these other schools. So they've got this great idea in New Orleans, one of these charter schools, this Psy Academy. It's a charter school there in New Orleans. They do these things called surveys, right? They give the kids entry tickets and exit tickets. So we're giving them golden tickets. Here's your entry ticket. Tell me what you remember from yesterday. Here's your exit ticket. Tell me what you learned today. And then they punch it all into a computer, and the computer then tells them. Isn't that what teachers do? I mean, I don't call them entry and exit tickets. I call them pop quizzes, and I call them tests. You know, so the teacher looks at them right then and there and goes, oh, this is what you're learning. This isn't what you're learning. This is what we need to work on. The teacher does that, right? Just a thought. Because I'm looking at this, and it's just mind-blowing on so many levels that we're reinventing the wheel with different titles and different names. And the money, well, we know where the money's going. The money's going to the top. The money's going to the big corporations. The money's going to the advertisers. Yeah. So I guess the question is it a survey or is it a test? What we're doing is in my view, just absolutely criminal. Just criminal what we're allowing to have happen right before our very eyes. Let's take a quick break right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Researchers have learned that the toxins that make snake venom deadly can evolve back into completely harmless molecules.
This discovery could lead to new drugs for life-threatening conditions including cancer, diabetes, and high blood pressure.
The toxins in snake venom evolve in a special gland in the snake's body. They start out as harmless compounds that have been doing different jobs elsewhere for the snake. In fact, a snake's venom gland appears to be a melting pot, a place for evolving new functions for molecules. Some of these molecules are retained in venom for killing the snake's prey. Others go on to serve new functions in other tissues in the body.
The idea that there are many harmless versions of venom toxins throughout a snake's body suggests a new avenue of drug development. Ex-venom compounds might be valuable because they're made up of what scientists call bioactive proteins, which already are naturally designed to target metabolic processes. And that's precisely what you need drugs to do.
So studies of deadly snake venom might lead to better human health. These scientists published their study in the journal Nature Communications in late 2012. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. For more stories about the human world, visit us at earthsky.org and follow Earth Sky Science on Twitter.
Search snake venom at earthsky.org for more on this story. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So this afternoon, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid announced that the Senate was going to suspend all work on the gun bill. Since yesterday, you saw the bipartisan background check agreement get shot down in flames. Reid said he was going to hold off on further votes on the bill so that you can allow the senators a little time to negotiate. And my thought is, hoping the American people get a case of amnesia and forget about it. Although the Senate Majority Leader said he was going to bring it back at some point in the future when they've done a little more negotiating. My view, Senate's given up. And the reality is, while the Senate seems to have given up, the people, you know, the people that they represent, they have not. And that's what it's going to take. Folks in the street, people calling their office, writing them letters, The loud majority in this case, I think, needs to be out and about telling the stories, telling what's going on, telling what's happening to them. And one of those activists I've got on the line, she is a survivor of an attack. She was shot herself, along with, a dear friend who was killed by a gunman. I've got Kim Russell on the line, who is an activist with Moms Demand Action. Their website, momsdemandaction.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Kim Russell, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me on.
So, it's a horrible tragedy. I read what happened to you, and, you know, just for background for our listeners, can you tell me what happened to you?
Sure. It was ironic because what happened to me was in 1999. It was 4 days after Columbine, and I was out with my friend Philip, who was a high school teacher at the time. So at dinner, we discussed how horrible the events were at Columbine and how they couldn't happen again. He was worried about his student's safety. He was worried about his own safety. And when we left the restaurant, we were held up at gunpoint. We were both shot, and Philip was killed. Since then, there have been 16 mass shootings. And nothing's changed. Newtown was my wake-up call. I had sort of, I guess, been living in a bubble. I think I felt safer, thinking that what happened to me was just a random act and it didn't happen to many people. And, you know, it felt safer thinking that. But after Newtown, now that I'm a mother of a first grader and a pre-K child, I could not do anything anymore.
You know, I think a lot of people feel the same way. It couldn't happen to me. That only happens to other people. It only happens in other communities. And the sad reality is since Newtown, I spoke with someone last night who said, you know, there have been 3,300 people across this country who have been killed with firearms. And you go, that is a massive number in such a short period of time.
Yes, it's really epidemic, our issue with gun violence in this country. And I almost feel bad that, you know, I didn't get involved sooner. You know, it took Newtown to sort of wake me up. But now that I've come out of my ambivalence to it, now I understand how tragic this is, how urgent this is. And knowing what I know now, it's impossible for me to stop and let this fade away. Regardless of what the Senate came up with yesterday, we're not going to stop.
Well, I hope this enrages people, and I hope more people get active and get involved with groups like yours, Moms Demand Action. Again, the website, momsdemandaction.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Kim Russell's name. Let me ask you this, because, you know, as I read your story, I'm thinking, you know, from the mind of my NRA gun-toting friends who say, well, you know, if Kim and her friend, Philip, if they'd had a gun, they could have fought them off. How do you respond to someone who would say that? Because, you know, I have a lot of people who say, well, I carry my gun. I would take care of it.
Well, you know, I think it's odd that people can make these assumptions when they were not there. I can say this. It was dark. The sounds I heard, I thought they were fireworks. I had no idea it was gunfire. It took me a while just to even realize that I was in danger. By that time, you know, I was terrified, and your adrenaline really takes over. It's hard to have the clarity of mind to know at that point you need to reach into your purse or your holster, grab your gun, aim it in the dark at this unknown person you can't see. To me, I think if I had had a gun in my case, I would most certainly be dead right now.
And the sad reality is the statistics are on your side in saying that, because, I saw a number of studies, and especially with policemen, the majority of policemen that are killed with their own gun within 3 feet.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, I live in New York City. You know, we had an incident outside of the Empire State Building where our trained police officers shot innocent bystanders by accident. You know, and it happens. Even people who are trained to use these weapons misfire. Most guns that are in people's homes to protect themselves are far more likely to be used in an accidental shooting than they are for protection.
Yeah, but everyone says, hey, that mother in Atlanta who, you know, shot the intruder 5, 6, 7 times, you know, that could happen to you.
You know, it could, but statistically speaking, that was very rare. I think what happens more often is that in New Jersey, a 4-year-old gets a hold of their neighbor's weapon and kills a 6-year-old. That is statistically more likely to happen.
Yeah, there was just a story, I think it was Tennessee, where a deputy sheriff set the gun down and a 4-year-old picked it up and shot the mother.
It happens all the time. Now that I'm involved in this work, I hear about these shootings every day. And I hear about them from all over the country because I'm now connected to chapter leaders in cities all over. So I'm getting local news from all over the place that I probably wouldn't have had access to before now. And I hear these stories every day. What I don't hear are, you know, the very rare stories like the one in Atlanta where the gun was actually used on an intruder.
So let me ask you, you know, because part of me believes our problem is our culture. You know, we've had guns pretty much rammed down our throats over the years in more numbers. Look, we've always been a gun culture. It's just been recently that, in my view, last 20, 30 years, that it's become as large of a scale as it's become. What can we do to try and maybe pull back from that? What's the solution?
Well, I mean, you know, we're trying to change the culture, and I think it's interesting that you said 30 years, because it was at about that time when the NRA really changed their view and went from being more of a, you know, a teaching people how to use guns safely sort of organization for hunters, to more of a lobbying organization, and more tied to gun manufacturers. That's about when that shift happened. So, yes, we are getting guns rammed down our throats because gun manufacturers want to sell them. But I think what we need to do is we need to go at this like mothers against drunk driving. You know, we have to create a culture shift and really educate people about the dangers of guns and how important a simple background check is to protect us. We are not at war with ourselves, but the statistics of gun violence in this country would seem as though we are. You know, it's sad that when something like what happened in Boston happens, and to think that whoever is responsible for doing that could go and get a gun with no questions asked. They could get it on the Internet, no problem. And that's not okay with me.
I think a background check
is a simple, simple fix.
Right, and I don't even think it's okay with the members of the NRA. In fact, the polling say that it's not. So
I know. It's you know, I feel like the leaders of the NRA are really out of touch with their members. And I think it just goes to show how there is a lot of greed involved in these decisions.
So you don't think it has any? You don't think that it would be an intrusion whatsoever on anyone's Second Amendment right to own and to bear arms?
Absolutely not. It's a background check. We've been doing them for a long time already. Since 1998, background checks have successfully kept guns out of the hands of 1.7 million people, I believe. So you know they work, and it's not a big deal to do them. I mean, we register our vehicles with the state, and if we sell that car to a friend down the street, we sign a title over, and there's a record of that vehicle being moved from one person to another. I don't think it's too much to ask that we do that for a gun, which is a lethal weapon.
But the NRA, my extreme friends would say that I don't have an absolute constitutional right to own a car. They believe that they have an absolute right, even though that's nonsensical, that they have the right to bear arms.
Well, I wish that they would really read the Second Amendment in its entirety and also listen to Justice Scalia with the Heller case.
Right.
You know, the Second Amendment states that we have the right to bear arms. Okay, I don't think that gives me the right to own nuclear weapons or a tank or missiles. And I'm okay with that. I don't need them. They're not designed for civilian use. So I think every amendment has its limitations. And we are not trying to take away people's right to own guns. We just think that they need some common sense regulation.
Yep. And to be, and for me, it's that responsibility thing, especially that my Republican friends used to love to talk about. That responsibility that, you know, if you no longer have your gun, it's been stolen, lost, whatever, maybe you should report it lost or stolen so that maybe if it comes up, we know it was stolen.
Absolutely. And you know, Wayne LaPierre supported expanded background checks in 1999. So why this sudden, you know, change of heart? Why was it okay in 1999, and why did it not infringe anyone's rights then, and now it does in 2013?
Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, I've had this conversation a number of times with people, because, you know, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I had a very different view of guns growing up as a child and as a young man, as someone who's been shot at and has seen people be shot and someone be killed and people be killed. I have a much different view now that I live in a rural setting where guns are seen more for sport and target shooting and hunting. I see the complete differences in my two situations. Do you think that conversation is being had? Because a lot of my friends who see the gun as a sporting tool, as a tool to hunt with, think, well, you know, it's just those urbans who don't know how to use guns. It's the drug culture. It's those people.
Look. Gun accidents happen everywhere. People need to be responsible if they own a weapon that is lethal. And, you know, we're not trying to take away anyone's hunting sport. You know, I'm from Georgia. I grew up with hunters. I grew up with guns in my home. But, you know, my parents were responsible with them. They kept them locked up. You know, if they did their background checks, the guns were registered. You know, it was a responsible situation.
Right.
And we're not trying to take that away from people. We're just saying that with rights come responsibility, and it's for the public health, safety of everyone. It's in everyone's best interest to do this, and a background check is not a big deal. You know, we've had them already. 60% of guns sold in this country already go through a background check. There has been no registry created, and no one has been knocking on doors and taking away guns. And even in the Manchin-Toomey bill, there was something in there saying that if anyone tried to create a registry, they would be considered a felon and face up to 15 years in prison. So they were even concerned and really went out of their way to make sure that there would not be a registry. So I really feel like the gun lobby just has a lot of power. They're basically just, you know, fear-mongering, telling people to be scared, to, you know, to stand their ground, when in reality, this is just about safety. This is a nonpartisan issue.
Yeah,
this is about our children's health.
So what should we be doing? I know that you're one of the leaders of Moms Demand Action. MomsDemandAction.org, the website. What should we be doing? Last line of questioning.
We got to keep going. I mean, you know, one thing that came out of this yesterday, one good thing that came out of this is our membership is spiking. We had more hits on our website yesterday than we have had since we were founded. So, you know, this, we are not fading away. We are in this. In fact, this is just more fuel for us. We're stronger, and we're going to keep going. If you go to our website, momsdemandaction.org, we're making it very easy for our members to send emails and tweets to senators. We want to thank the senators who supported us and let them know that there's no horrible backlash for doing the right thing. And then we also want to shame the senators who didn't and let them know that we'll remember how they voted. When they're up for re-election.
Yeah, and hold them all accountable. Kim Russell, I appreciate your time. Thank you for your story. Thank you for your passion, and keep up the great work.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
You know I told you once tonight. that you could always speak your mind. You work so hard to say what's right. I watch you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the anti-immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strike breakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours and a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in Labor's Forgotten Massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer Massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.ricksmithshow.com.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
We're talking about China Grove. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. So Marco Rubio has been making the rounds. Last Sunday was doing the TV tour, did the Talking Head Bobblehead series. I think it was on 5 or 7 of the morning shows, pimping his immigration idea. Well, today been doing the talk radio circuit. I was on with Rush Limbaugh. And Limbaugh told him, said, "Hey, you know what, polling shows that 75% of Hispanics, they think the government is the prime source of prosperity." And Rubio agreed. Said, "Oh, man, it's a growing problem in America. People think that the government does everything." And no, that's not what we believe. There's a lot we believe. That's not it, Marco. He goes on to say, "I think we have a growing problem in this country that too many people have forgotten what the true sense of prosperity is. And he goes on to say that he blames the Republicans because, you know, they've embraced welfare and they've embraced corporate welfare and cronyism, and which is true, although the cronyism and the corporate welfare. And he goes on to say, look, you know, we haven't explained the free market, how wonderful it is. We need to do a better job of explaining free enterprise is the only way to consistently create the kind of growth and opportunity that America has always been identified with. He says, you know, we're about the true free market system, free enterprise. And, you know, I think about that and go, really? When have we really had that true free market? Well, we really haven't. Later on, Marco was on another program where he said, look, you know, if you don't support my plan, if you don't support the immigration plan right now, if you don't do it now, Obama's gonna give amnesty to everybody. He's going to legalize everyone. And he points to the DREAM Act. He says, quote, in fact, I think it's possible that they could give legal status like they did to the DREAM Act qualificators. Qualificators, is that a word? Anyway, he says, I mean, people who qualify under the DREAM Act, they could do the same thing to millions of people more. And what would stop them from doing that? Oh, I don't know. An act of Congress? Because you're supposed to do your job. And look, I mean, there's a lot in this immigration. This bill, I don't know what's all in it yet. We're still working on that. But for me, it comes down to some simple stuff. I do believe if the Republicans are going to be behind it, there's going to be a lot of guest worker visas, a lot of HB1 visas. And what that's going to mean, that's going to mean flooding the labor pool. And, you know, I've been reading these stories about the HB1s, how we need them, and how there are all these success stories. And, you know, this guy came from here, and this guy came from here, started this business, started that business. And, yeah, great, fantastic, amazing. But you came here working for $20,000 a year as a computer programmer when the people who went to college here can't find jobs doing it. Don't you have a problem with that? I do. I have a problem with other countries, and I guess it's what we've been doing for a long time. Other countries have educated their people, they've invested in these people, and then they come here, and it's basically stealing from other people as well. And look, I don't have a problem with people who are going to bring assets here. The problem with immigration is now we're going to pick and choose the winners. We don't want the sharecropper. We don't want the poor people. We don't want those folks that our policies have created over the years. We don't want those, especially from Mexico. So for me, when I look at this, I'm wondering, how many of these guest workers are going to come in? How much of it's going to spill over and going to pull us all downward? And over the coming next week or two, we're going to be talking about this because I think this is one of those important pieces of legislation we better get right. I'm sure there's a bunch to this that we don't know. Maybe there's some big fences being built, which I'm not against. Build them. Build a moat for all I care. Maybe actually talk about creating jobs. Just a thought. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher, Stitcher, Stitcher on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Quick break, right back with hour three. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
I'm with you now. Until the end.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Seven Florida teachers are suing the state over a 2011 law that they allege is violating their constitutional right to due process and equal protections. The complaint claims that by eliminating tenure for new teachers, but not for older teachers, it creates an unequal class system in the schools. Additionally, under the law, job performance is gauged partially by standardized tests, and those tests can include information that teachers didn't teach in the class. For example, the standardized test could include testing on math topics that the teacher being judged hasn't taught in her classroom. The Florida Education Association also joined the lawsuit, which was filed Tuesday in Gainesville Federal Court. The AFL-CIO is substantially expanding its non-union worker program, Doug Cunningham reports.
Working America, the AFL-CIO community affiliate consisting of non-union workers, is expanding to all 50 states in the U.S. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka told The Nation magazine that Working America has recruited more than 3 million people who aren't in unions to join the labor movement. Working America Executive Director Karen Nussbaum says the expansion into all 50 states will also mean beginning to organize in workplaces. Working America plans to double its number of state chapters over 3 years, with the goal of having chapters in every state by 2018. Nussbaum told The Nation magazine she wants to give workers the tools they need to get into motion at the workplace and in communities. She said labor leaders have told her they need Working America in every state. Working America is supported financially by the AFL-CIO, but the organization is working on economic self-sufficiency as it expands the number of chapters around the country.
More Republic Allied Waste workers have gone on strike, charging the company with unfair labor practices. Workers in Memphis and Millington, Tennessee, stopped collecting recycling, alleging that Republic unilaterally cut wages without negotiating with a union representing those workers. According to the Teamsters, some workers saw their paychecks slashed by upwards of $200. The strike follows workers in Georgia walking off the job Monday, alleging that Republic has refused to bargain fairly over a contract. Additionally, workers in Youngstown began an unfair labor practice strike on March 27th. Republic workers in other areas of the country have also stopped work in solidarity with those currently making the unfair labor practice charges. Strikes have been reported in Washington State, Arkansas, Mississippi, and Indiana.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
For the root of the horn. When the walls came down.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Yesterday, nearly 1,000 Blue Mountain High School students took to the football field, left class at the morning bell to protest the expected teacher layoffs and the program cuts that are going to happen thanks to the underfunding by our governor and by our state legislature. The cuts are being forced because of the underfunding, $1.4 million budget deficit to this small school district. And we're seeing this across the country, this defunding of public education, this force closures of schools like we see in Philadelphia and in Chicago and elsewhere. And like these kids up in the Mountain School District, taking to the streets, taking to action, taking to social media, saying, you know what, enough's enough already. We want good, solid, local, public schools, and we're going to fight for them, which is why I've asked Dwayne Truss. He's the assistant director of Raise Your Hand Illinois, fighting these school closures in his community to come talk to us. Also the grandfather of two in as well. Dwayne, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, how you doing there? Thanks for having me on.
I am good. You know, I'm looking at all of this action. You know, in a very small school district, in a rural part of Pennsylvania, you got 1,000 kids who came together and said, you know what, we're going to protest teachers being cut and programs being slashed. We're seeing this all across the country where there's an awakening going on, I think.
Yes, it is. We also here in Chicago have the Voices of Youth that about 3 weeks ago had a protest downtown protesting the proposed closing of 53 elementary schools in Chicago.
And as I understand, that was supposed to be more than double the 53 that they announced they were closing. Was that, 129 they initially announced they were closing?
Well, initially, you know, the mayor, Rahm Emanuel, has been playing games. Initially, they started to list at over 300 schools because they came up with this, you know, unfounded, you know, utilization formula to say that we got these, you know, empty schools. And they pared it down to 129, and then they pared it down to 53 schools. And right now, you're talking about 30,000 children, 89% of them African American, who's going to be impacted by the closing of these schools. And one of the issues we point out to people is the fact that, you know, they talk about they need to close schools to redirect the resources, but it appears that they're redirecting those resources into charter schools and to turnaround schools, which is operated by a private operator called Academy for Urban School Leadership, other known as AUSL, and it's pretty much ran by venture capitalists.
Well, I mean, it seems to me the direction education's heading here in Pennsylvania. It's the same story. We're handing it off to the corporations and the profiteers, and at the expense, I think, of kids and my kids' future.
That is correct. You know, Mayor Rahm Emanuel alleged that, you know, he needs to do this to in order to save money for the Chicago Public Schools and redirect resources, you know, into poor communities. But if you've been keeping up with this, with what's happened in Chicago, the Chicago Board of Education just announced a bond issue of $330 million that's going to add $25 million a year to the Chicago public school system to finance these school closures. So, you know, they alleged that there was a $1 billion budget deficit, which there isn't. It was something that was just manufactured by the mayor. And now they're going to borrow $330 million to carry this out. So, here it is, you're claiming a $1 billion budget deficit, you're going to borrow $330 million, and you're going to incur more debt to Chicago Public Schools.
You know what this sounds like to me, Dwayne? You know, you listen to, you know, when Romney was running for president, you heard a lot about the companies that he bought up, leveraged with a massive amount of debt, ran through bankruptcy and made tons of money off of consultant fees and made tons of money off of taking the money out of the companies. This sounds a lot like that. It sounds like we're saddling up the public school with all of this debt and all of this depreciating assets, the schools that are crumbling that we're not fixing and we're not reinvesting in. And then we're building this whole other thing that the privateers and the private companies and the profiteers are going to take over. It seems to me like a heist, man.
Definitely. We have a charter school operated here in Chicago, which is a political favorite of the mayor, called UNO Charter Schools, United Neighborhood Organization. They pretty much got into the charter school business. And they received a $98 million grant from the state of Illinois to help them build new schools. But also what UNO did was they borrowed over $100 million in order to finance the construction of these schools. And, you know, when it comes to construction, sometimes there's cost overrun. So right now UNO, you know, pretty much had borrowed the money, pretty much, you know, their bonds are like rated junk bond status, but they sold those bonds. So if UNO can't pay those bonds off that they use to finance the construction of their new school, then guess who's left holding the debt?
You are.
The taxpayers of Illinois.
Nice. Now, I mean, that's a perfect business solution. That's very, very business friendly of you to secure their debt for them.
That is how they got it arranged, you know, with their friends in Illinois legislators, well, with the mayor of Chicago. And unfortunately, we have a situation where, again, Chicago keeps saying that they're broke, but they seem to always find money to finance capital improvements into charter schools, like, for instance, HIP Charter School. CPS sent $3.5 million to renovate a building at Lathrop School, in which it's 50% utilized, but CPS saying that they got to close neighborhood schools because they're underutilized, but yet you got them spending this kind of money on an underutilized charter school. And then they're sending, they announced a new school for KIPP to co-locate into this neighborhood high school, John Hope, on the south side of Chicago. And CPS is going to spend about $6 million for that renovation. So they seem to find the money that they want to for charter schools.
And I guess that's where the priorities are. But, you know, I listen to that, and You know, what gets me is I've heard those stories so often where public dollars are taken and used for private interests, and you know, it's frustrating on so many levels that what bothers me is even politically, I don't know who my friends and who my enemies are. You look at Rahm Emanuel's a Democrat. There are a lot of Republicans for it. Obama's a Democrat. Most of the Republicans are for it. Here in this state, it seems to be a very bipartisan thing because it's the billionaire money that's behind it.
Yeah, we like to call Rahm, you know, a Democrat in name only, a dino, because he'll go ahead and just carry that label. But he's pretty much dancing to the tune of the billionaires and the millionaires. Like, for instance, you know, we got this thing called tax increment financing that the state law in Illinois allows for, where basically the city of Chicago can divert money that's supposed to go to the Chicago public schools and use it for development. So right now there's $30 million on the table for this development in what we call the River North area, which is a very well-to-do area. And the purpose of TIF is to help develop blighted or poor neighborhoods and create jobs. So here you're getting this $30 million subsidy to a developer and contributor to Mayor Emanuel to go ahead and subsidize this new construction for this new office building.
But what do you say to people who say, look, the Chicago schools are struggling. They've created this environment that all these inner city schools are, quote unquote, failing. And then they offer this wonderful opportunity where they keep saying, you know, these charter schools, they're the new thing. They're the future. We've got so much success. In fact, so much success that there are tens of thousands of people on waiting lists who are just dying to get into these things. Even though the last report I read on it said that's not actually true, but you know, it's the talking point. What do you say to that? How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, WBEZ Radio here in Chicago at 91.5, you know, pretty much exposed the lies about this waiting list to be charter schools. Because what CPS does, they have this thing called New Schools Fund, which is basically where, you know, the venture capitalists and the venture philanthropists, you know, put money into to help charter schools start up. And what they do is they finance this major fair at Soldier Field in Chicago, where Chicago Bears play. But they bring in, you know, all these parents to say, well, we got these quality school options for you. They pay for buses. It's heavily marketed. They pay community groups and some of our elected officials, unfortunately, to encourage people to go to these fairs, and they collect applications. So a person may go to the fair, and they may, you know, not necessarily complete an application, but they may get their information taken by 10 different charter schools. And so that one person may submit either 10 inquiries or applications, and then the charter schools will turn around and say that, oh, we got this tremendous waiting list.
Bang, but there's again, 10 people.
The WEZ went to the Illinois State Board of Education website and did some research, like, you know, our mainstream media here in Chicago needs to do, and found that there's no such waiting list. And also during the teacher strike, the executive director, it was so ironic, the executive director of ICHE's called the Illinois Network of Charter Schools, as well as Warren Rangel, who's the executive director of UNO, who got the $98 million subsidy, was out there with a press conference saying that, hey, we got 3,000 seats open in our schools for those students who's out of school because of the teacher strike. So you got this tremendous waiting list that they're saying that to justify the need for more charter schools, but yet they got all these empty seats in the charter school. And by the way, I live in the Austin community here on the west side of Chicago, and we got schools that are kicking the charter schools in the teeth in terms of their academic performance. But you won't hear that from the mayor and Barbara Bird Bennett, because they don't want to, you know, close their prized school. That's why they came up with this scam called utilization, because they knew that, you know, that some kids, you know, bought into the color brochures and the extensive marketing by these charter schools who promised parents free uniforms, free iPads, free laptops, and they went for it. And so, you know, they're in these charter schools, but yet when you look at their performance, the neighborhood schools, especially here in Austin on the west side, are outperforming them, you know, hands down.
That's an interesting thing you brought up, to the heavily marketed part, because I just talked about a story the other day that, you know, I said, you know, how much money, I think $22.5 million the one company spent just in the first 8 months of 2012 of on advertising, and that's, you know, $22.5 million by this one private education company that isn't getting into the classroom. That's $22.5 million that I think I'm paying in taxes that are going into education that are actually just going into to propping up these charter schools and these cyber charters.
Oh yeah, definitely. You know, I've read a report where, you know, Rupert Murdoch and Fox are supposed to be getting into online education, and that's a big thing, you know, being pushed by Bill Gates also. Is, you know, that, and unfortunately, this is something that's been directed towards inner city urban areas, you know, poor communities in districts which serve a large number of poor students, saying that, hey, you know, we got this great online curriculum that we want to sell you, and they know that they're going to make money. You know, they set these phony non-profits up, and they say, well, it's a not-for-profit, so we're going to provide this, you know, online service. And it's going to save the school district a lot of money because basically what they want to do is just break, you know, teachers unions. Not only just break teacher unions, but as you say, profit from public education.
Right.
Because in Chicago, 52 cents of every dollar paid into property taxes is supposed to go to the school system. So we like to say in Chicago there's 6 billion reasons why, you know, the private industry want to get into public education, because there's a constant cash flow of $6 billion. You know, in the operating budget, and then there's the capital budget of the Chicago Public Schools, which goes to new construction and maintenance of the buildings. So those are very lucrative contracts, especially when it comes to high-tech testing. One thing our organization is Illinois, raise your hand. Well, it's raise your hand for Illinois Public Education. One of the big issues we're pushing back against is all these high-tech tests. I mean, Chicago Public Schools, you may have to take up to either 6 to 8 tests during the school year, which we calculated takes away 25% of classroom instructional time.
Yeah, I just, you know, to be honest, I just opted my daughter out of the state tests here that I think are just ridiculous and with too much pressure and too much nonsense and really no help for her. I mean, I just think it's ridiculous. But let me ask you this. You know, you mentioned Bloomberg, you mentioned Murdoch and Bill Gates, and you know, there's the Bloombergs of the world that want to get into education. And there's this thought out there that these people are very successful. They're billionaires. Gates runs Microsoft. Murdoch runs Fox News. That these people know how to run things, so they should take over the education system, because places like Chicago have been reported, places like Philadelphia, you know, Cleveland, these are failing schools, these are failing school districts, and we need these people, these handful of people to come in and save us.
Yeah, well, you know, I want to say something real quick about, you know, Bloomberg's, you know, his daughter, she's, I think, a board member with, we call them Stand On Children, the AstroTurf so-called group that's out there advocating for children in education, which is pretty much, you know, trying to privatize the school system. They believe these corporate, you know, driven models work for schools. Well, we have this millionaire venture capitalist, Bruce Rauner. He just retired, and he heavily invested in the charter schools. Well, one thing about Bruce Rauner, he's great at making money, but he was lousy at running a charter school. He had this charter school on the west side, a high school called, I think, the Academy for Communication and Technology, and that school failed miserably when it came to its finances as well as its, you know, academic. And, you know, CPS, rather than lose the charter because there was a certain number of charters that the state of Illinois allocated, they just suspended their charter. And then what they did was, before they lost the charter, they contracted with another performing charter school called HIP, you know, that they get so-called national reviews, but when you peel back the layers, they're actually probably the worst performing charter school around, especially in Chicago, and they're considered what in Chicago a level 3 performing school, which is the lowest. So CPS gave that entity a contract to operate ACT, which is a failed charter school ran by millionaire Bruce Rauner. And so they gave it to a level 3 performance school to operate that school. So we have a prime example where, you know, Bruce Rauner was directly involved in operating of a charter school, which failed and still is failing.
Sounds absolutely ridiculous. So what do we do? Last question. How do we fight back this? What are you guys doing? How do we stop this?
Well, we just have to, you know, just keep organically educating people. You know, we have a great executive director, Wendy Catton. is doing great research. We got great parents. You know, we are a volunteer organization, and we have parents, you know, constantly doing, you know, the work that CPS should be doing and really giving, you know, our goal is to use research data and information to empower parents, because parents are the best advocates for the children, and to make sure that parents understand, you know, what's going on and giving them the research and the tools so they can effectively push back against this. And as we educate parents, you're getting more and more of a pushback against the mayor. And, you know, for the most part, he's going to be a one-term mayor.
Yeah.
And we're going to win this battle, this war, and push back against this corporate reform because, like I said, Bill Gates, he has only one vote. Rupert Murdoch, he has one vote. Bloomberg, he doesn't live in Chicago, but he couldn't vote anyhow. But it's the people in Chicago that we're going to work with, and we're going to educate, and we're building up, you know, it's been moving tremendously. So we're going to, in the long run, we're going to win out.
All righty. Well, I hope you're right, and I hope more people get involved and we take to the streets and take this back. Dwayne Truss, I appreciate the time, Assistant Director of Raise Your Hand Illinois. Thanks so much.
Welcome to Craig, wasn't a board member.
Oh, okay. Sorry. A board member.
Oh, no problem.
Thanks okay, so much. Yeah. Quick break, right
thank
back.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
All right.
Stick around. Right back after this. Thanks. That's your cue to...
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Razor Tattoos presents Get On Board, an art show to benefit autism. Get On Board features custom, one-of-a-kind artwork on skateboard decks from nationally renowned tattoo artists and fine artists. All proceeds go directly to the Autism Society, Greater Harrisburg area. The initial public showing will be during the Derby Inc. Invitational Tattoo Convention at the Farm Show Complex, April 19th through 21st. Visit facebook.com/getonboardforautism. That's facebook.com/getonboardforautism. Sponsored by Razor Tattoos.
Earth Day cometh, the 43rd year of this national focus on our globe. Should we weep or cheer? Both. The first step toward any recovery is admitting that we have a problem. In fact, beaucoup of them. For example, despite the squawking of profiteering polluters and professional deniers, our very atmosphere, without which everyone and everything is dead, is rapidly being degraded by our addiction to fossil fuels, literally altering Earth's climate in disastrous ways. Yet, as we burn, our policymakers fiddle. Let us fiddle with the tar sands in Alberta, Canada, they demand, uncaring about the vast amounts of ozone-destroying carbon that will be released by ripping open the boreal forest to get at the junk oil, or the extra carbon dioxide contamination that will come from processing this especially toxic sludge. Also, let us fiddle with the earth itself by fracking deep underground shale to bring gas, oil, and ozone-depleting methane to the surface. Oh, and let us keep fiddling with the priceless ecology of America's ancient Appalachian mountains by exploding off the mountaintops, merely to make it cheaper for big coal to extract more ozone-killing ore. There are plenty of horrors to make you weep on this Earth Day, but tears don't bring change. That comes only from the determined effort of ordinary grassroots people to organize, strategize, and mobilize. The good news for our Earth and our own existence is that such people are on the move in every part of America. They're confronting the greedheads and boneheads, creating effective energy alternatives, forging fresh and sensible policies, lifting heads out of the sand, and producing the change we must have. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's what Earth Day is about. Don't weep. Cheer the progress we've made. And join the movement for more.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
I'm passionate about our economic liberty because I have witnessed our free enterprise system as it rewards the hard work of many and creates prosperity for all in this great country. And over the past few weeks, we've seen a frontal assault on free enterprise.
Once I made you rich enough to forgive my name, in Youngstown, in Youngstown.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So interesting stories. Couple of things from Kansas. Former senator and current governor Sam Brookback Mountain signed a bill on Tuesday into law that we're going to start testing for drugs. You know, those welfare people, and we're going to start drug testing. You know, those unemployed, make sure they're not on drugs. Fact of the matter is Kansas is now the very first state in this year to implement the ALEC and Big Pharma backed legislation. And, you know, you look at this, I ask, you know, how much more do we have to push down on people? I mean, if you sign up for help, are you going to have to prove that, oh, you know what? You're not using anything? I'm concerned about a lot of this. And why do I have to defend myself if my employer takes my job? Now, the law was passed with a Democratic Party added provision that would test legislators as well. But how are you going to test legislators if they're not collecting welfare or unemployment? I mean, it seems kind of ridiculous. But the law now requires that a urinalysis be done of any welfare recipient or any person who has their job taken from them and files for unemployment benefits. Swept right through the House, swept right through the Senate, signed eagerly. And you go, you know, really? Personally, I think it's unconstitutional. But here again, I guess they've got tons of money to spend on it as well. Also on Tuesday, Governor Brookback Mountain there signed a law prohibiting local governments from requiring contractors to pay prevailing wage. This is what's coming to Pennsylvania. I understand it's going to, this is the goal. The goal is to get people to work for slave wages. So they're in Kansas, another one of these states saying, nope, we're not going to make anybody, no more prevailing wage. Kansas repealed its state prevailing wage law in 1987, but you know over the years they've mandated that people who use state money do. Now I look at this and I often wonder, and I had this conversation earlier this morning with my wife when we sat down for breakfast. You've got these people who make these laws. Most of them have never done an honest day's work in their lives. They went from college into you know some cushy gig and then off into public service. And there's nothing wrong with public service. But I think if you're going to vote for something like this, if you're going to push something like this, you should know what it's like to have to work for a living and to go out there and swing a hammer and do this kind of work. This is hard, backbreaking work. And I love the people who say, you know, the market should determine what wages are. Well, here in Pennsylvania, the prevailing wage is the market wage. The market has dictated, based on all of the people who report their wages, what the prevailing wage is. And as I explained it to my wife, it's a very simple concept. If you have 20 contractors who pay a carpenter $20 an hour, and you have 5 that pay a carpenter $30 an hour, and you have 10 that pay their carpenters $9 an hour, what's the prevailing wage? And my wife got it immediately. The prevailing wage is 20 bucks an hour. That's what the market is paying for that job. And what we're saying by saying that the prevailing wage is, look, this is, you can pay above the prevailing wage. Nobody's saying you have to pay less than, you can't pay more than the prevailing wage. It just says you can't pay less. So it's setting that floor saying, look, you know those people who you're paying $9 an hour? You're going to have to bring those up. So there's fair competition across the spectrum, and we get quality people doing quality work. Seems rational to me. Seems reasonable, doesn't it? But not in places like Kansas, not in places like here in Pennsylvania where they want to undo all that stuff. Because, you know, it hasn't worked over the years, has it? We don't have a high-skilled construction industry, do we? Of course we do. And the reason we do is because people can make a reasonable wage out of it. And in those states where you can't, guess what? You have transient labor coming through. Seems pretty simple to me. I mean, and the problem with all of this is you look at this stuff and you go, hey, what's the underlying reason? Oh, we want to save taxpayers' money. No, that's not it, because you're not saving anything. The studies that I've seen and the chances where you can look at real time what happened when they did this stuff, how did it work out, never goes the way the righties or the business people say it's going to. Always goes against the taxpayer. It's like this austerity thing that they keep pushing down on us. Now they're saying, oh, gee, you know, maybe we had some wrong assumptions. And there was another thing I saw where, you know, maybe the whole premise was off because we didn't know how to use a spreadsheet. You know, it's the ideology. Because, I mean, just from simple common sense, explain to me how taking money out of the local economy, if you're stealing it from workers or if you're just defunding education or defunding programs that happen, how is that going to help grow the economy? By taking money out, how does it help? How does it make things better? Well, it doesn't. It makes things considerably worse. And there's part of me believes that's the plan. I guess it's cynical, isn't it? Yeah, is what it is. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk with Luke Vargas from Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. Right back after this.
You know they're going to push us around. Mr. Heff and Digger, Mr. Hardigan Hauler, because I'm going to leave it in the ground. Mr. Taft and Digger, Mr. Hardigan Hauler, Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. It's gonna take a lot longer than 80 short days for this miner to cool on down. This half can dig it, Mr. Hardy can haul it, cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So as I said earlier today, as the Senate is walking away from the gun stuff, and it looks today like, you know, they're trying to run from this. You know, people are getting involved. People are getting active. And look, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com, you're going to want to hear the earlier interview. Anyway, let's find out what's going on around the world and across the country. I've got Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Luke, thanks for taking time for me.
Sure, of course. Good talking to you.
So, you know, you look at this gun thing, and again, I look at it and go, well, I guess this is the end of it, right? We tried. We got shut down. Next.
I guess it wasn't axed until today, but I think we've talked about in weeks past that this really looked like it was going to end in failure. First, you had the assault weapons ban going down. You had clip limits being taken out of this bill. Then you had background checks removed, and you're sort of left with this very weak piece of legislation that Joe Manchin and Senator Toomey say they're going to try to do something with. That's breaking off a separate bill for mental health checks before anyone buys a gun, which seems like a no-brainer to me. But, that's where it looks like this bill is now. Harry Reid says he's putting it on pause and that they're going to return to it in a few months, which on one hand sounds, like a great excuse for failure and pretty much a tacit acknowledgement of it. On the other hand, though, I wonder if the public debate hadn't started to mature as this legislative process is winding down. I was looking at this new 30-second spot that was produced by a group called States United to Prevent Gun Violence. And I should have linked it to you before the show. It's a 30-second spot that people may have seen. It involves a man walking into an office building holding a pretty long barreled gun. And near the end of about 15 seconds into this 30-second spot, he shoots at one of his bosses, presumably maybe someone who had fired him or something like that, and he misses. And the following 15 seconds are him, reloading an American Revolution-aged musket. And it's going to take him a minute. And in the process of those final 15 seconds of the ads, everyone safely evacuates from the building. I thought that to be the kind of PR campaign to try to change the conversation on guns that we haven't heard in the past few years. And maybe things are coming around on the polling.
Yeah,
that legislators are giving up.
Yeah, I agree. And did you see the commercial, the one just like that they didn't use, where it was me standing in the background being shot by the errant bullet that didn't hit the intended target?
Sure. It was a little unexplained exactly how that whole shooting went down in the video.
Because that would be my luck. My luck would be you. Someone would come after you, and I would be the one getting shot.
Well, unfortunately, that's exactly what happens in many of these instances when there's more than one bullet per round, essentially. So I think the message there was very effective, very clear. And the question, I think, it becomes if this legislation really is going to boomerang around and perhaps come back to Congress in a few months. Again, I have no ability to predict when that would be that it would come around, but there seems to be a potential that at least the landscape could change a little bit during that time, and that there may be a little bit more for politicians to work with. But again, it's really hard to tell where the public opinion stands on this relative to the legislative ambition.
Well, I'm looking at this, and they're going to put it off a couple of months, hoping that the vast majority of Americans who generally suffer from amnesia will get another bout, and it'll fall off the radar because there'll be another crisis that's manufactured, or there'll be another who knows what, another explosion in Texas or another horrible thing that happened in your neck of the woods there in Boston.
Sure. An observation that outside of my journalistic capacity, but I mean, it does seem to be that what happens so often on the gun debate is that the instances, the particular tragedies are just different enough that people don't all put them in the same, bin of analysis. And there are so many situations, it seems like, where gun control or at least background checks on people having access to weapons, could potentially have prevented incidents. But yet each of the incident is in itself going to be a little bit different. And the problem is that people don't line them up together. So I think we're looking at similar risks here.
Yeah, but being someone you're generally in a more urban setting. I now live in a more rural setting. I grew up in a very urban area in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. There are two very different worlds when you're talking about gun ownership, I think. And I think that has to enter into the conversation as well.
Right. And I think there are people who would say that it enters into the conversation by letting states decide this issue. That, however, doesn't look like it's really going to be a feasible strategy going forward either. There's going to need to be, really added provisions on guns, or there's going to just be a very laissez-faire approach, as we've sort of done so far. I don't really see how you proceed on this without more federal legislation. It looks like where things are going to happen.
Yeah, do you see this as a huge loss for the president? I mean, I've seen a lot of rhetoric. I've seen a lot of commentary on this is the biggest defeat of his presidency, and this the end. And I don't know. I'm not seeing it as... I didn't think it had a chance of passing from the very beginning. So the fact that it met my expectations, I don't see it a huge loss. I see it as the guy actually having the conversation, so we're talking about it.
Sure. Obama, the president, had on his Facebook page released sort of a meme or some sort of advertisement that had one of those square Instagram-like photos, and it had a quote from his speech, I guess last night, saying, "We're going to get this right. This is just round one." And to some extent, I agree with you. You know, didn't maybe we saw this trajectory happening all along, and that it's inevitable that the first iteration of a gun control bill would be shot down. But I do have to think that a lot of political capital was spent on this. If we look just at the stories that have come out about the Newtown families that have been campaigning, and they've really partnered up with lobbying firms to get them incredible access to senators and congressmen, and they've been beside the president at every juncture through this. I don't know how much longer those big public figures are going to be able to keep weighing in on this debate before people start, you know, just paying attention to them less. Gabrielle Giffords, also a figure that comes to mind, where she has an incredibly emotional connection to the gun control issue. But yet it does become an issue. How many editorials can she write that still have that same emotional value? And, yeah. And I do think political capital has been spent on this to a pretty large degree.
I agree, but I still give him credit for making the move. Because it's the right thing in my view.
Sure. You know, I'm also thinking about an NRA statement today that said that, you know, this is proof that Obama bit off more than he could chew. And that's something I also partially disagree with. And I'm not sure if this would have been a lot more successful if Obama had gone piecemeal on these issues, if he had considered the assault weapons ban separate from everything else, if clip limits and background checks had all been separate bills. I don't know if we would be at this point looking at a mixed success instead of sort of a complete failure like we've had now. So it's hard to really gauge the president's performance here, but there's certainly no bill in the next few months.
Yeah. The other big bill that just dropped, the immigration bill. What do you see in this that's any good?
It seems to be the opposite of you know, the politicking we saw in gun control. You've got Marco Rubio, a big political figure on the Republican side, putting his reputation on the line with this. It's sort of the opposite of, again, the opposite of what we've been seeing with guns. It really does seem to be the solitary piece of economics or jobs-related legislation that the GOP is getting behind. And this gang of eight that presented the bill today, four Republicans, four Democrats, you know, I do think there's going to be Republican support for this bill, and it's amazing to watch Congress function on two entirely different levels at this point.
Well, I mean, for me, it comes down to they got their guess, or they're going to get their guess. Worker program, cheap labor, yeah, more HB1 visas, yeah, good cheap labor that we can exploit. I can't see how the Republicans would be against it, and the added bonus of being able to go to the Hispanic community and say, see, we don't hate you.
Sure. Marco Rubio had a press conference, or actually not a press conference. He took to the floor of the Senate a few hours ago and was talking about this bill. And the only thing he was really complimenting was the high-skilled workers, the high-paying immigration visa program that's contained in this bill. But as anyone who's, well, I guess not many people have looked over all 900 pages of this bill, and that statistic bears repeating. But there's a complementary program for low-skilled workers, people with low-paying jobs, and that really does, when you're looking at numbers, the many millions of people involved here, you're going to be dealing with a lot more cases of lower-skilled and lower-paid workers than you are these sort of highly lauded, very technically advanced and highly educated jobs that Rubio is talking about.
Yeah, and you know, some of the stories I've been reading lately about this HB1 visa program is, you know, they're getting computer programmers from all over the world. They're paying them $20,000 to $25,000 a year. Well, we've got computer programmers. We've got people who do the coding and do all that stuff here. They just won't work for $24,000 to $25,000 a year.
Sure, and fluctuating too. Some of these areas of the workforce that this bill is targeting just weren't around a few years ago, and it's hard to tell whether they're necessarily going to be the jobs that we need just a few years from now. So I think it's interesting. You're right that, you know, sometimes we're bringing in people for jobs that we could be getting here. But there are instances of people who come to American universities and are essentially having their tuition, you know, really aided by our own government and taxpayers. And you'd want those people to stay in the country if they wanted to. So, you know, hopefully that's where this bill is going to be making an impact.
So last question on the immigration thing, because, you know, I go back to the Bush era immigration ideas. You know, the guest worker program that they're going to set up, which has been something they've wanted for some time. Will we be chipping them? Because I remember during the Bush years, we were going to chip them. Because we need to control. We need to know where they're going. So we're going to put RFID chips in them, and so we can track them.
You know, I haven't heard about that. I'm surprised it hasn't been floated around more often. I'm sure there are some senators out there that would still cling to that. But look, the people who want that probably wanted a border fence, like Bush was talking about a few years ago, and it looks like they won on that issue. So,
Luke, I want a border fence. I want a great big border fence, not because I think fences work, but because I want to start building stuff. I want to put people back to work. Because as soon as you build a 30-foot fence, you got a factory that props up right next to it building 31-foot ladders, or another one that builds shovels. I'm okay with that.
Right. I think we may have talked about last week. Again, building a fence often means something different than it did a few years ago. There are ways you can not only put down the infrastructure as far as a wall is concerned, but you can add to that digital fencing, essentially, added security features and possibly the deployment of drones to monitor the border, and you're dealing with a fence that, when it can be breached by a ladder, you can also identify where that ladder is before it even starts going up. So I think that's the reason we're seeing progress here, is because this idea of a border fence is actually probably a more feasible and, a more successful proposition than it was 10 years ago.
Do you want to stop immigration problems in this country? I mean, the simplest way to stop immigration problems of people from Mexico coming into the U.S., undo our insane trade policies and let the Mexican people have their farming communities back and let them, let them have their own industry and help prop up those industries by having some rational trade agreements, not this insanity that we've got because of NAFTA.
Well, I don't think we're seeing that anytime soon.
If you really wanted that, it's just my thought. And lastly, I know you're up in the Boston area. Have you had your fill of misery porn? Because I can only see so many blown up things, and I can only then see the pictures of the latest suspects.
It's been rough, but I have to say personally, I was doing some radio shows on Monday, and I normally don't find myself at a loss for words, but was tongue tied a number of times during those interviews, and it's been hard. It's been rough, and as much as I try to take the journalistic separation here, I have to say it's amazing to read so many of these articles. From all over the place and posts from friends on Facebook and see names that I recognize, commenting on stories, contributing to articles and also being among some of the injured people here. It's been pretty tough to deal with, but at the same time, really makes me like Boston a lot, and I'm heading back tomorrow to be with friends and family.
Yeah, I saw the FBI not too happy with the news media.
No, they're not too happy with the news media, and they're also not thrilled with the online community that's sprouted up, that's been dissecting these photos and contributing sort of amateur FBI-style analysis, like 4chan and Reddit and Facebook. There's some tremendous forums, which are actually very interesting and informative to look at, where just minutes after the FBI released those 8 photos today, you had people identifying the brand of hat that they were wearing. So on one hand, you look at this sort of amateur effort, and you say, wow, this is an incredible way of getting information, but it's all happening in the dark. The FBI is not commenting on individual accusations or theories at this point, so it's hard to know whether these communities are playing catch-up or if they're ahead of the curve. It's interesting, though.
Yeah, it is interesting. What I found really kind of disturbing, though, is we've got this view in our head that it's going to be a Muslim guy. And when you start thinking that way, that's all you're looking for.
Sure. One of the posts I encountered on Reddit just a few minutes ago was a forum where an individual had taken the photos released by the FBI, which from my own opinion looked to be very light skinned males, and the person had done some color changing on the photos and said that it's proof that these people had more olive colored skin and moving it, though they may be from Yemen or from other places. So it does become dangerous to start trying to meld what you're seeing into what you want to see. There seems to be a good deal of that happening this week.
Yeah, I forget who it was yesterday that said the Muslims have they've been practicing being Hispanic. That they're trained, Louis Gohmert, that's what it was. Louis Gohmert said that, Islamists are trained to act Hispanic, which I just thought was really just bizarre on so many levels.
Well, it's been an incredible exposition of the nuttiest people on earth this week, as everyone tries to comment, from the gentleman who was criticizing the Newtown families for being involved with the guns, I guess that Minnesota radio show host, to the person you just described, to CNN, to the New York Post. It's really been a rough week when it comes to honest reporting and straightforward commentary. And we're getting all the nut jobs are floating to the top.
Yeah, see, I expect a radio host to be a nut job. I don't expect a U.S. congressman to be a nut job.
No.
But that's the sad thing. Anyway, Luke, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
Pleasure. Take care.
Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. From the top.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Earth, sky.
Researchers have learned that the toxins that make snake venom deadly can evolve back into completely harmless molecules.
This discovery could lead to new drugs for life-threatening conditions including cancer, diabetes, and high blood pressure.
The toxins in snake venom evolve in a special gland in the snake's body. They start out as harmless compounds that have been doing different jobs elsewhere for the snake. In fact, a snake's venom gland appears to be a melting pot, a place for evolving new functions for molecules. Some of these molecules are retained in venom for killing the snake's prey. Others go on to serve new functions in other tissues in the body.
The idea that there are many harmless versions of venom toxins throughout a snake's body suggests a new avenue of drug development. Ex-venom compounds might be valuable because they're made up of what scientists call bioactive proteins, which already are naturally designed to target metabolic processes. And that's precisely what you need drugs to do.
So studies of deadly snake venom might lead to better human health. These scientists published their study in the journal Nature Communications in late 2012. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. For more stories about the human world, visit us at earthsky.org and follow Earth Sky Science on Twitter.
Search snake venom at earthsky.org for more on this story. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Long as I remember the rain been coming down, while the mystery forest confusion on the ground.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. So earlier we talked about a giant sinkhole that swallowed up three cars in Chicago. And, you know, I've been saying that Harrisburg is kind of the sinkhole capital of the U.S., 41 sinkholes in the last year. And it's my view on it. I haven't run the numbers, but it seems 41 sinkholes seems like an awful lot. But you know, when I said earlier, it swallowed up three cars, just gone. And you see the size of this mammoth hole. You go, wow, this is impressive. Well, Chicago Public Radio is calling that giant sinkhole that swallowed up the three cars, they're calling that a pothole. And, you know, I guess you could go, screw Texas and Chicago. Potholes are the size of you could swallow up three cars. And I guess, you know, when I had done some research into it a couple of months ago, there are like 600 sinkholes each and every day in this country that don't get reported because most of them, well, don't swallow up three cars. Most of them don't swallow up a garbage truck. Most of them don't swallow up some half of someone's house, and you're never going to find them again. Most of them create a nuisance. You go in, spend a boatload of money to fix them when you should have been doing the maintenance all along to make sure that, guess what, they don't happen. And for me, it comes back down to infrastructure and what we should be spending money on. And this idea that I hear floating around, probably only one guy, it's probably just Mad Cow, who has come up with this idea that, you know, we really shouldn't use the liquor store money for education. No, no. We don't want booze for books. No, no. We want shots for streets. Yeah. In fact, you could make that a drinking game. For every pothole you hit, you got to take a drink. Why not? I mean, if we're going to be funding roads with liquor, why not make a sport out of it, right? Just seems dumb to me. A lot of what goes on in Harrisburg and in Washington seems dumb to me. And it seems dumb to a lot of people. And there's part of me that believes that's by design. The design is to get people like you and me and other people who want to get to the best result to just throw up our hands and go, you know what, the system's broken. Well, we can fix that. We can fix that by being involved, by not giving up, by not saying, well, you know, it's all broken, they're all crooks, it's all rigged. Because it's easy to do. I mean, it really is. I mean, every time you turn around, there's another scandal. There's another, crook getting caught. Just the other day, I saw this story down in Tennessee. 24 IRS workers got arrested for theft. I mean, that is if I were a right wing talk show host, if I was one of those right wing anti-hater, anti-government people, I would have a field day. I mean, the truth of the matter is, there's a field day to be had. You've got IRS people who are stealing. I guess the right wing argument would be, well, what's the story? Interesting story from Iowa, and you gotta love when honesty comes into the picture. Doesn't often, but you gotta love when it does. One of the Iowa Secretary of State, who's a Tea Party guy. He was elected in 2010. A guy named Matt Schultz. Talking about voter ID. And you thought that was all dead, didn't you? You thought that whole voter ID thing was dead? Oh, no, no, no. At least not in Iowa. That turn evidently going to be one of their top goals in Iowa is to put voter ID into place. And Mr. Schultz says that the reason that you should back voter ID, he said there are a whole lot of reasons that people like him and the people in this room, the room that he was talking to, care about. He says those important issues are abortion, gay marriage, and a whole lot of social issues that we care deeply about. He said, but you don't have to start caring, but you have to start caring about voter ID and election integrity. Because if you don't have that, you'll never be able to make a difference in any other issue you care about. So when I hear that, because he says, you need to start telling your friends and your neighbors that you love voter ID. You love voter ID. Because his view is, look, if we can't suppress the vote enough, if we can't hold the vote down, then we can't impose our will. And we can't put those women folk in their place and put the queers in their place and put all those others in their place. Here's what I find interesting. Because, he says that, the other side, they cheat. So the reason we need voter ID is because they cheat. The definitive study on this in Wisconsin found the fraud rate to be 0.0002%. You've got a better chance of being struck by lightning than you have of finding someone committing voter fraud. So say what it is. It's suppression of the vote. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on your smartphone. We'll see you back here tomorrow.